is a glut of wealth in the city of Saba. Everyone has more than enough. Even the bath stokers wear gold belts. Huge grape clusters hang down on every street and brush the faces of the citizens. No one has to do anything. You can balance a basket on your head and walk through an orchard, and it will fill by itself with overripe fruit dropping into it. Stray dogs stray in lanes full of thrown out scraps with barely a notice. The lean desert wolf gets indigestion from the rich food. Everyone is satiated with all the extra, and no one wonders about the unseen world. People of Saba feel bored with just the mention of prophecy. They have no desire of any kind. Maybe some idle curiosity about miracles, but that's it. This overrichness is a subtle disease. Those who have it are blind to what's wrong and deaf to anyone who points it out. The city of Saba cannot be understood from within itself, but there is a cure, an individual medicine, not a social remedy. Sit quietly and listen for a voice within that will say, be more silent. As that happens, your soul starts to revive. Give up talking in your positions of power. Give up the excessive money. Turn toward teachers and prophets who don't live in Saba. They can help you grow sweet again and fragrant and wild and fresh and thankful for any small event. The city of Saba cannot be understood from within itself. But there is a cure, an individual medicine, not a social remedy. Sit quietly and listen for a voice within that will say, be more silent. Starts to revive. Give up talking. In your positions of power, give up the excessive money. Turn toward teachers and prophets who don't live in Saba, they can help you grow sweet again, and fragrant, and wild, and fresh, and thankful for any small event.
That Rumi. That was Rumi again, the great Persian teacher, great Sufi master. Okay, we were reading something about poverty consciousness and how to transmute that stuff. And Kuan Yin is doing the talking, so I thought maybe I'd just finish this. Just back up a sentence or two. You all walk around with blinders on, playing pin the tail on the donkey of my life. You do not know where you are going. You do not know where you have been. You wear the blinders and you try to pin what is in front, whatever is in front of you. Because since it is there, it must be for me. You trip over yourselves, not knowing what you want to be when you grow up. Ultimately, what you want to be and what you want to remember is what you come from the heart, is that you come from the heart of the Creator. You are a divine child of God, Goddess, all that is. You have the same abilities as the Creator. You are not a victim on this earth ship. You are each as a compass that is certain and has certain directionals. It is time to point yourself in the direction of your heart's desire. Is that hard to do, everybody? Heart's desire. Is that so hard for you to see? Can you look into your heart and see what it desires? Why are you afraid to allow your heart's desires to be made physical? Are you afraid that your heart will hurt you again? It has done everything for you. It has done nothing against you. Everything has always been for you. You are all in a magnetic flux. You go around and around and around, chasing your tail, as does that beautiful spotted dog. This is dog energy. It was in everything, you know. It was a picture of a dog on that other piece. Like doing dog is man's best friend here, dog energy. Turn it around, it says God. It is time to stop running around and move forward. It only takes you believing to make it happen. For you, just point your compass in any direction and move toward it with your words. Fluctuation is part of creation. Just because you move from situation to situation, or heart to heart, or job to job, or state to state, or fear to fear, does not mean you are a bad person. It just means you are confused. Humanity is programmed to think that they should only have one destination and no variations from that path. As you vary from your path, then you are not a responsible person. You are not to be one thing. Is God one thing? No. God is a multitude of dimensions, universes, star systems, galaxies, multitudes. You are a multitude as well, a multidimensional being. As you fluctuate in your creation, it is okay. As you beat yourself up for what you think is a mistake, you beat up all of humanity for that mistake, not just you. It is as one little blood cell declaring and decreeing to all of the body. Quote, I am poison. I am bad. I am not a good blood cell. Unquote. Cancel clear. What is going to happen from that? That little blood cell will draw to it others that are like and of the same nature, eventually forming a tumor of some type or a blood clot of some type. The goodness will not be magnetized toward that kind of decree. The power of the spoken word, everybody. Power of the positive thought. So, as you decree, say out loud, I am beautiful. I am perfect. I am truly moving toward my heart's desires. Just those words will move you in the direction of the compass of your heart. Stop beating yourself up. Do you think that God sends himself to his room when he creates something that is not viewed as the highest good? No. He views that creation and expands from it. He or she does not punish him or herself for what has been done. He does not bring it out every day to look at it and give himself 20 lashes because of it. Opus Dei does that. Forget it. Cancel clear. He realizes that he created it. It is okay. It is then released to be formatted into a higher state of being at the very next level of creation. He does not linger in memory lane. As such a thing were to happen to the creator, then you would not exist. He would have stopped long before humanity and earth were ever birthed. Here are many other existences and star systems that are a million times worse than you, even on your very bad days. Understand it is okay. Do not punish yourself for your creations as they appear to fail. They have just outlived their usefulness for that moment. That's all. You are a special creation. We will end this talk at this time. We have given you much to chew upon, and it is not necessarily pleasant. Understand the effect that you have on all things, not just yourself. As you do not love yourself, you send that screech, just like that little blood cell did, throughout all of existence. As you renew your vows of poverty, you do it for all of humanity. Understand that you are effecting and affecting everything. You are one drop in an ocean of life. One drop changes the chemical outcome, the chemical balance. Each day, as you drop your thinkings, your negatives, your denser droppings, shall we call them, into life, you pollute it. Do not do this, just not for you. Rather, you pollute it for everyone you love, everyone that you want to love. Be responsible. Think responsibly, create responsibly and lovingly. That is the way that we are birthed. We were not thrown together haphazardly. A lot of thought, a lot of love, a lot of time went into each and every cell of each and every of us. Each of us, God specializes in each of his, her creations. Each is created through the heart of the Creator because he, she knows all creation is an outpost of self. It is an extension of selves, little self, higher self, soul self. Our world, every part of it, every person in it is an extension of who we are and how we create. As we do not like the way it looks, as we do not like the backdrop of it, let's understand that it was our creation and that is our responsibility to shift it. We will leave. We are the Council of 22, Pleiadian energy that is in alignment with your highest truth, the brightest possibility of our being, and the deepest love of our very essence. Guess what? It's the 22nd of March, and we just got a visit from the 22 Pleiadian energy elders, along with Kuan Yin. All right. That was very nice. Nice. Okay, this is a little more sober. We did some nice elevating stuff. I think I want to play this piece, Lord Rama. Well, it's about something that was on Democracy Now. This was on a couple of weeks ago, but I thought it was important to know about. And just, you know, something to be aware of and get on the case of. Sometimes we need to do that. All right, just a second while I am. Okay, I got to start it at the beginning here. Okay, we're going to get moving with this in just a minute. Okay, here, Rama. Go over there. Okay.
Style campaign to bury it. Stay with us.
Yashoni
Palenga, Yashoni Palenga,
Yashoni Pamatu,
Yasimolusi,
Yashoni
Palenga, Yashoni
Palenga, Yashoni Pangampella,
Yasimolusi,
Yashoni Palenga, Matu,
Yashoni Palenga,
Yasimolusi,
Yasimolusi,
Yashoni Palum Fundes,
Yashoni Palenga,
Matua Palace, Manishoni. We are Shone Palum Cocker,
Yashone Palenga,
Scotty City, Shone
Pisimonelosi,
Yashone
Palenga,
Yashone Pamatu,
Pisimonelosi,
Yashone
Palenga, Yashone
Palenga,
Sibonelosi,
Pisimonelosi, Yashone
Palenga,
Yashone
Palenga,
Sibonelosi,
Pisimonelosi.
Yashoni
Palenga,
Yashoni
Palenga,
Sibonelosi,
Sibonelosi,
Yashoni Palum Fundis,
Yashoni
Palenga, Bunkukeli,
Sibonelosi,
Palum Shumaye,
Yashoni
Palenga.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are with Mariah Blake, staff reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. The scary new evidence on BPA-free plastics and the big tobacco-style campaign to bury it is her new piece. What is the campaign to bury the information, Mariah Blake?
Well, there are multiple facets to the campaign, but the primary objective is to cast doubt on the scientific evidence linking these chemicals to human health problems. So, and there are various ways this is done. In the case of BPA, for example, the industry-funded studies, which were biased studies that found that the chemical was not harmful to health. And there's a sort of network there. They published them in certain journals that in many cases had links to the tobacco industry. They relied on scientists that in many cases had helped to discredit the science linking smoking and secondhand smoke to disease. So in many ways, they didn't only borrow strategies and tactics from big tobacco. They are actually relying on the same cadre of experts that big tobacco relied on to bury the truth about smoking.
I want to turn to a video made by the plastics industry featuring the vice president of Eastman's specialty plastics division, Lucien Baldea, speaking in the video made by the company. A pregnant woman is one of the people shown buying plastic products as Baldea speaks.
We understand that there are concerns about plastic materials that are used in consumer products that consumers use every day. Those products include water bottles, baby bottles, and food storage containers. We can see how available information about plastic materials can be confusing and how it can be difficult for consumers to tell what is really safe. We want you, the consumer, to know the facts behind our clear, tough material named Triton. Consumers can feel confident that the material used in their products is free of estrogenic activity. Consumers should have high expectations of the products that they use, and no one is tougher on our products than the researchers and engineers at Eastman Chemical. Most importantly, we have used reputable, independent third-party laboratories that have used well-recognized scientific methods to prove that Triton is free of estrogenic activities. Numerous regulatory agencies around the world have independently reviewed our data and have approved the product for use in food contact applications. Some of the world's most recognized brands trust Triton as their ingredient.
That was Lucien Baldea, who is president of Eastman Chemical's Specialty Plastics Division. Can you respond to this, Mariah Blake?
Well, the Eastman product called Triton, which is the product that Baldea is speaking about in this video, is actually one of the primary focuses of my investigation. A number of independent scientists have tested this product and found that it is actually more estrogenic than polycarbonate, which is the plastic that contains BPA. And Eastman Chemical, according to internal documents which were released as part of a lawsuit, has taken pains to suppress the evidence showing that its products, or that this product in particular, is in fact estrogenic.
So How is it the EPA isn't regulating this?
Well, and this is one of the most surprising things to me when I was reporting this story. So there are about 80,000 chemicals in circulation in the United States. Virtually none of those chemicals has been tested for safety, or a very, very small fraction of those chemicals has been tested for safety. In general, chemicals are presumed safe until proven otherwise under the U.S. regulatory system. So when a chemical like BPA is removed from a production line, the industry will substitute another chemical that is untested. And we really, in many cases, just don't know the health effects of that chemical. So it's largely an unregulated realm.
Tell us about George Bittner.
Okay. George Bittner is a neuroscientist at the University of Texas, and he has launched an independent lab called Certicam. It also has a sister company called Plastipure, and it tests products for estrogenic activity. And he, working with a prominent Georgetown professor, he and his staff tested, I think it was 455 commercially available plastics that are on the market, and published a paper in Environmental Health Perspectives, which is the premier NIH journal, which found that virtually all commercially available plastics have estrogenic activity. And among the plastics he tested were Triton products, several Triton products. And this publication, this finding, prompted a pretty big backlash from the industry. So he ended up being targeted by the industry as a result, and in fact was sued by Eastman, which is many of the documents that form the basis of my story were released as a result of that lawsuit.
I want to read from a memo that Eastman's senior chemist, Emmett O'Brien, wrote after customers began asking about George Bittner's tests that showed that Triton may still be estrogenic. O'Brien describes a meeting with Whole Foods executives who are considering replacing their polycarbonate bulk food bins with ones made from Triton. He wrote, quote, "We called Bittner a mad scientist. They didn't know his name, actually. They asked twice by two independent people what we thought of them. I hemmed and hawed, ducked and dodged, saying I prefer not to comment, but we joked and pushed and flat out said the guy was shady. With this non-stereotypical crowd, it was a good term." O'Brien added, "They asked if they could do their own tests. I mentioned the cost is very high, and they were quick to chime in that the tests take very long." Can you respond to that, Mariah Blake?
I think you chose the most telling possible quote. So this was effective. This was the strategy they used. Firstly, they worked to discredit Bittner, and they did this through a campaign of personal character assassination, and by calling his business practices into question, and secondly, they worked to discredit the science. So one of the things that Eastman did was they claimed that the test that Bittner is using, which relies on a specialized line of breast cancer cells, had been rejected by the EPA, when in fact it hadn't. The EPA is considering using this very line of breast cancer cells for its own screening program for what they call endocrine disrupting chemicals. BPA is one of those. So the other thing they did was they commissioned their own research. So they paid labs to perform research which found that Triton was not estrogenic. But if you look at the research closely, you'll see that it is the studies are essentially designed in a way that guarantee that estrogenic activity will not be found. So, for instance, they use a type of rat. It's called a Charles River Sprague Dolly rat. This rat is known to be insensitive to estrogens. So it can withstand doses, according to one Japanese study, 100 times higher than a human female can withstand and show absolutely no effect. They also used doses that are below what is known as the no observable effect level. So the doses that are known not to cause an effect. And they then published their own study in a scientific journal, which is has numerous tobacco industry ties, finding that, that Triton was, in fact, not estrogenic. So that is essentially how they responded to the finding that their product contained these chemicals that, that are potentially harmful to human health. They attempted to cover it up.
Your report cites some leaked minutes from a 2009 meeting of the BPA Joint Trade Association, whose members include the American Chemical Council, the American Chemistry Council, Coca-Cola, Del Monte. During the meeting, they explored messaging strategies that included using what they called, quote, fear tactics. For example, do you want to have access to baby food anymore? The attendees agreed that the Holy Grail spokesperson was a, quote, pregnant young mother who would be willing to speak around the country about the benefits of BPA. Mariah.
Yes, and this is one of the most disturbing things I discovered during the course of reporting this, is that in their efforts to portray plastics as safe, they oftentimes target the groups who are most vulnerable to the effects of these chemicals. So prenatal exposure and exposure during early childhood is potentially the most harmful, and oftentimes the marketing of these products targets pregnant women, targets families with children, and also Eastman, for example, in their efforts to portray their products as safe, also targeted these specific groups.
Can you talk about Nalgene bottles, Evenflow, is it Evenflow, Tupperware, Rubbermaid, Camelback?
Yes, all of these companies produce at least some products that are made with Triton. So, and they're not alone. There are hundreds, probably, of companies that use this. This is the only plastic on the market that markets itself as being free of all estrogenic activity. So many companies that cater to consumers who are concerned about their health, and many of the high-end consumer brands have started using this plastic. I think the thing to keep in mind is that Eastman misrepresented their product to their customers as well. So these brands are not necessarily to blame for this. They have been told by Eastman that Eastman performed independent third-party testing and found no evidence of estrogenic activity. And so in many cases, it appears that these companies are trying to do the best thing for their customers, but they were not given accurate information about the plastic that they use in their products.
Last week, NPR did a report, maybe that BPA in your canned food isn't so bad after all. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So this is based on a recent study that was performed by FDA scientists. This is a $30 million taxpayer-funded study. And the FDA used many of the same tactics that the industry uses. For instance, they used the Charles River Sprague-Dawley rat. The other thing about this study is that the lab appears to have been contaminated. So the control group of rats, these are the rats that are supposed to not be exposed to BPA, so that you have some sort of a baseline to measure the animals that have been exposed to this chemical, they were somehow accidentally exposed to BPA. I have been talking to scientists about this, and I'm planning to write about this later this week. And the academic scientists I have been speaking to say that this raises very serious questions about the validity of the findings, and it's unclear whether any conclusions can be drawn based on this study.
Hmm. What most shocked you in all your research, Mariah?
Boy, that's a good question, because there were a lot of shocking things I discovered. I would say there's a couple of things. One, the fact that so few of the chemicals that are in the products we use every day have been tested for safety. So as I said, there are 80,000 chemicals that are in commercial use in the United States. Only a tiny fraction of those have been tested for safety. Two, how how easy it is for the industry to bias that safety testing in their favor. I had, obviously many of us know about big tobacco and the way they were able to essentially buy science saying their products were safe. But I was not aware that that was happening on such a grand scale today, and it really is. Plastics, as I worked on the story, it became evident to me that this is not the only industry. The plastics and chemical industry is not the only one that is using these tactics. These tactics are fairly widespread. And I guess on a micro level, one of the thing that surprised me most, in Bittner's testing, he looked at various types of commercially available plastics. And one of the types of plastic that was most frequently estrogenic was the corn-based plastic. So the plastic that is biodegradable that you often find in restaurants, health food stores, that this is potentially one of the most harmful types of plastic.
Explain that again.
So Bittner looked at various kinds of plastic. Bittner and his colleagues, when they tested plastics, there's a variety of different kinds of plastic. Polyurethane, PET, PET, polycarbonate, all these different kinds of plastic. So he broke it down by types of plastic. He tested a number of samples of each one, and in the final paper, they showed what percentage of each type of plastic tested positive in their tests. And there is a type of plastic that is frequently, you'll find it in Whole Foods, you'll find it in health food stores. It is corn-based, and it is marketed as biodegradable. Oftentimes, there are forks made out of this, for example, mm-hmm. in health food restaurants. I believe the statistic was 95% of samples made out of this kind of plastic tested positive for estrogenic activity.
So what are you going to do with your three-year-old? What have you decided
to use? What I've already done is removed all plastic from my home. So I have switched to natural materials. We use glass or stainless steel for our Tupperware, for our sippy cups, for everything that we possibly can. Plastic is unavoidable, so we still buy food packaged in plastic because there is no alternative. Saran wrap, actually, in Bittner's tests, I believe it was somewhere around 99 to 100% of plastic wraps tested positive for estrogenic activity.
And where does the EPA come down when you question them about when they're going to be regulating some of this and the way that they regulated BPA?
Well, the EPA still does not regulate BPA. The FDA banned BPA in sippy cups and bottles at the request of the industry. So, the agency still insists that BPA is safe. So the industry asked the FDA to ban it because they wanted to reassure parents that their products are safe. There has been no meaningful regulation of any of these chemicals with the exception of phthalates. And in the case of the EPA, they have a program which was supposed to screen these 80,000 chemicals for what's called endocrine disruption. So the endocrine disrupting chemicals are chemicals that mimic hormones like BPA. And this was supposed to be at least partially done by 2000. They still haven't fully vetted a single chemical. So the industry has managed to throw stumbling blocks in their path. And delay is the name of the game, essentially, sowing doubt and delay. So...
And how much does the plastic in water bottles and juices leach into the water and the juices?
PET or PEET, which is most commonly used for water bottles, is, I believe, 75% of samples in Bittner's study reached estrogenic activity. There is another study performed by scientists in Germany, which also found that this particular type of product was estrogenic. So it seems, based on the available evidence, that many or most of these bottles leach estrogen.
And the longer the bottle of water you buy sits, is the water becoming increasingly contaminated?
Well, there are certain factors that increase the risk of these chemicals being released. So exposure to UV rays, heat, if they're put in a dishwasher, these are the things that are known to increase the risk that these chemicals leach out of plastics. So with reusable plastics in particular, this is a concern. If you boil them, if you put them in your dishwasher, if you leave them in your car, that causes plastics to break down, and it's more likely that estrogenic chemicals will leak into whatever those containers contain.
Well, Mariah Blake, we want to thank you for your research. Staff reporter with Mother Jones Magazine. Her story is just out in the new issue. It's called The Scary New Evidence on BPA-Free Plastics and the Big Tobacco-Style Campaign to Bury It. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. You can also follow her on Twitter. Later today, she'll be doing a Twitter chat with readers. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to try to reach Medea Benjamin, who's just been deported from Egypt.
Okay, that's good. That's never mind for that. Okay. Just a moment. There it is. Okay, I'm gonna do this.
On this show, I like to feature grassroots activists and artists that have politically or socially conscious messages to bring to the table. A lot of these voices you'll never hear on TV because radical thought is marginalized in the mainstream. Which brings me to Jamie Dunmore. He's a young spoken word poet from England whose viral online poetry videos caught my eye. His poem, My Call for Humanity, invokes a call to action for people everywhere to tap in to what it means to be human. I like the content of the piece so much that I asked Jamie to come on and perform it for you.
So here I am, standing alone in the open. I'm here with a message, hoping to repair what's broken. Nature is struggling, humanity's not on track. We've got our heads in the sand and our pride intact. We seek fulfillment through wealth, but do we achieve it? We want prosperity through consumerism, but is it worth it? Have we actually found freedom, or have we lost it? Because all we do is follow a system and never really challenge it. Can you relate to that, or is the world too blind to see? I'd always seek the truth, but care what my peers thought of me. I saw a different perspective and struggled by the hour. See, I knew ignorance was bliss, but knowledge could give me power. So now I call for humanity, not just for one nation. I'm opposing separation and standing up to segregation. Whether religious or atheist, in essence we're the same. Stereotypes are man-made, and it was man who created the game. But are we actually ready to accept this and wake up? Can we put our naivety on the line, or are we always going to collide? Are we ready to make a difference? Do we venture into the unknown, or do we stay in our comfort zones and keep on taking the easy ride? Because at sea, it's ships that are safest at shore. But no, that's not what ships were made for. So ask yourself this, why are you really here? You may find that deep, but my question really is sincere. For my generation, are we misled as a youth? Do we rub off our true purpose due to false misleading truth? Are we prone to propaganda? Are we prone to wrong information? Are we taught to judge each other based on religion, sex, race, culture, class, nation? The list goes on. So it's time to start improving, and it's time to start speaking, because resources are lowering and poverty is increasing. We allow cities to get larger, buildings to get taller, but trees to get shorter and forests to get smaller. We're an ingenious species. We could easily change everything, but we're made to think different due to decades of conditioning. We conform to education to confirm our own security, yet it's a biased institution that makes wisdom hold obscurity. Is it actually correct, and does it actually judge intelligence, or is it just listening to our elders and improving our obedience? Are possessions an illusion of worth? Are we tricked in our thinking? Are we trying to buy wholeness, and are we trying to buy meaning? Do they always give joy? Do they distract us from reality? Do they determine our identity, and do they alter our morality? I mean, what are our goals? This really isn't a joke. Can happiness be superficial and our routine a hoax? Do we live for the wrong things whilst the right things choke? Is mainstream TV legit, or can it dictate our attractions? Does it actually bring us together, or does it separate us into factions? We categorize each other via a social hierarchy, but status is made by humans, so who really are we? Is ego destroying eco? Are the real problems disguised? Do we really know the truth, or does our society feed us lies? Are we actually filling our voids, and does money hold any true weight? Could we drop our precious comforts to renew our planet's state? It really is time to stop living our lives in shells, because doing nothing for others is the undoing of ourselves. We're all from the same source, so let's see it for what it's worth. We only have one home, and that home is planet Earth.
In your poetry, you talk about needing to seek out information in a world, kind of a web of lies. Was there a particular moment for you when you realized that the government and media were lying to us?
I guess there was no specific time in my life that really made me question things. It kind of happened over a long period of time. But it was mainly when I was in education in school, I started questioning authoritative figures such as, you know, tutors and teachers and stuff like that, and really questioning where they got their motives from and how they were teaching us. And I don't know, I guess that led me onto a lot of introspection in a sense then, and that's what really made me question entirely what goes on in this world, and mainly just what we're being fed, you know, because I feel like the government and the media portrays this false sense of reality in a lot of ways.
And there's a theme also that calls into question kind of consumerism, and you're kind of urging people, can we ever come away from consumerism? Why do you feel passionately about the need to do that?
I believe consumerism is, I believe it's okay as long as you don't take it as a priority, you know. I believe materialism is okay as long as it's not priority, and I think the problem with consumerism is that it kind of makes us forget that we're human beings most of the time. We sort of, like, gives us labels and false identities that takes us away from our true nature. And that's, I guess that's what I'm really trying to challenge and make people go back to their authenticity, their simplicity, rather than focusing on materialism, you know, and things aren't necessarily natural from a human perspective.
You know, you're from the UK, a close US ally to our war machine, kind of partners in crime there. How do you feel about that partnership and kind of this overly militarized union of all these Western powers?
Well, you know, I like to see the world from an Earth perspective, as if I'm an alien, you know? I don't like to see it as if I'm a human being living in a certain country. I like to see everybody in the human race as my family, rather than saying that, you know, British citizens are my allies, Americans are my allies. You know, I see everyone in humanity as my family. I don't believe that Western countries actually have any authority over, like, Middle Eastern countries. I believe we're all equal. That's what it comes down to at the end of the day. And, like, I always come to the question, you know, why was I born a British citizen? I had no choice to be born British. I had no choice to be born this allied Western person. So it's all luck. So when I know that, I question Middle Eastern people, and I always believe that they're the same as me. So what difference really is there?
I couldn't agree more. Borders are meaningless.
Yeah, borders are man-made.
Everything's man-made. These borders that we invent these divisions between us to really separate ourselves, and the hubris that people have to think that we can go and invade other countries and tell them what's best for them.
Yeah,
really, you know.
Yeah,
nobody
else. Yeah, exactly.
You know, you performed the poem "My Call for Humanity."
Yeah.
What would you say? I guess if you could summarize, what is that call?
To wake up.
Yeah.
Yeah, to see life from another perspective, I guess, you know. It's okay to question things. It's okay to see life from another perspective and not the perspective that mainstream TV feeds down to us, you know. There's a lot more to life than what we're told. And I guess I just really want people to see that, because it's opened a lot of things up for me, and it's really made me, like, appreciate life in a lot more ways, you know. I appreciate nature much more. I'm not so stressed all the time. I see life for what it is. And that was the main call, you know. I want people to work together and realize that we're a team. Humanity is a team. There's no borders. There's no different nations. At the end of the day, they're all artificial constructs that we've made.
Thank you so much coming on, sharing that. Where
exactly.
Can people find out more about your work, Jamie?
You can search me on Twitter at Jamie Dunmore. And you can search me on YouTube, Jamie Dunmore, Michael for Humanity, Why Hate Society, Beloved Humanity.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Abby.
Trip. Coming up, I'll talk about the disturbing resegregation of America's public schools. Stick around.
on our ground and contaminate.
Yeah.
But it's easy.
You get a free pizza, Lee, if Chevron explodes
your house. All about having a monopoly over us.
Speaking of great solutions that are kind of being stifled by the corporatocracy right now, let's talk about the fact that marijuana is being recognized as a cure for cancer. I mean, Lee, this is just insane. I mean,
it's a horrible idea.
I wanted to really quickly just explain this. According to molecular biologist Christina Sanchez on Cannabis Planet, cancer cells actually commit suicide after cannabinoid. Am I saying that word right?
Something like that. I'm a expert, not a scientist, all right?
THC actually switches off pathways that allows tumors to grow. This is incredible,
right? And it's getting more and more accepted, but we can't allow that because if you allow medicinal marijuana, then it could cause, like, a run on Tostitos. You know, it could cause a spike in the Cartoon Network ratings. Abby, we can't have that, all right? It would be a catastrophe.
Why not? Then we can print our own food and then eat it after we get high and prevent the cancer. It just all it all works out.
Which, print the food.
Which brings me to the 3D printing thing. I mean, really, 3D printing can revolutionize production, manufacturing, democratize so many things. As if it's not mind-blowing enough, the fact that lasers can print things from the bottom up. Organs! I mean, for God's sake, in 2014, I mean, how many people die every day on organ donor lists? They will not have to anymore, Lee. They're going to get organs. It's insane.
They're very close to organs, which means just around the corner, printing babies. It's got to be right there around the corner. Which then brings, there's an interesting ethical questions, Abby, as to, like, can you hack into a friend's computer and just print him babies?
Can you hack into a baby?
While he's not home. And he comes home to, like, 10 babies, and he's like, it's not funny! All right, man, they're all over the place! You know, it's interesting ethical questions.
Yes, indeed. Let's hope that they don't start cloning and printing babies, all right? I mean, no, it is crazy. I mean, I think it can print organs.
No,
I mean, what the hell?
Here's the thing. If we allow this technology to go out to the masses rather than just be like something rich people have access to, printing organs and that kind of thing, it could save lives. It could change the world. But the problem is that you end up with corporations having a stranglehold on it.
Right. Well, I think that, like computers, people will be one step ahead of the corporations in terms of the hacking and be able to make their own 3D printer and stuff like that. Let's hope so. Let's talk about a little bit of a disturbing story. The fact that humans can now implant leads into cockroaches. Lee, apparently control their movements by remote control or an iPhone app.
I
don't even know what to say other than the fact that it's just really
disturbing. We can now remote control cockroaches. But with an iPhone app, which is interesting, because aren't iPhones kind of controlling us? I mean, we think we're controlling the cockroach, but really, how many people are able to detach from their iPhone? So I think we're unknowingly controlling ourselves via that. That video, I thought it was of a remote control cockroach. That is actually Congress, and the controller, that's ExxonMobil. So that's... I thought it was a cockroach.
Well, Congress has a lower popularity than cockroaches, as disgusting and vile as cockroaches are. That says a lot for Congress. Maybe we can remote control Congress and have them actually do the bidding of their constituents.
That would be very nice if we could just implant some leads in Congress.
They already look like they're just being kind of robotically controlled anyway with the lobbyists. Let's talk about probably the most amazing technology I've seen. I mean, other than 3D printing, this is just absurd. Straight up Harry Potter style, invisible cloak time. What in the hell? Lee, I don't even understand. Let me quickly really say.
Yeah, yeah.
The Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of Toronto has created a cloak adaptive to different objects and sizes, not full-fledged invisibility yet, but we're steps away from being Harry Potter. I mean, what the hell's going on? How is this going to affect society when everyone can hide behind an invisibility cloak?
And of course, whenever something like this comes out, it's immediately like the military is often behind it and they want to use it for all kinds of like death and destruction or spying, you know, things like that. But I think it could be used for good, you know? It could be used for just wonderful things, like watching people in the shower, or you could wrap it around Carl Rove so no one has to look at him anymore, or watching people in the shower. There's that one, too. Whenever you mention invisibility, people are always like, I know you can watch people in the shower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, is that really that great a thing? I mean, in our selfie, narcissistic world, most people would just volunteer to be watched in the shower nowadays. Outside this building, a guy just offered to me. He was just like, well, watch me now. So I don't know why
there's
that's
like a portable shower. Yeah. Like here, just
I don't know why that's what people are going to.
I like the Carl Rove hiding him more than the shower thing.
Yeah.
So we can print organs while wearing an invisibility cloak, and have cockroaches make our dinner, Lee, how in the hell is this going to change the world, and how is it going to change the way we live
in it? It's a wonderful future. I actually do think the potential of humankind right now is huge. It's bigger than it's ever been. The question is whether we can focus on achieving that, or whether we continue to be lost in, like, this vapor cloud of vapid nothingness, you know, these distractions and subtle arousal of screen flashes and car crashes, whether we can look past that and actually progress as a species. That's the question.
That is the end-all question, Lee. Let's hope. For God's sake, let's hope that we take the latter or the former, whatever you said. Lee Camp, thanks so much, man.
Appreciate Thank you, Abby.
You guys, that's our show. Have a great weekend. And join me next week when I break the set all over again. In galactic news, one of the biggest discoveries of the century has the scientific community popping champagne bottles. It all started some 13.8 billion years ago with the creation of the universe itself following the Big Bang. See, for decades, scientists have wondered if the Big Bang theory could ever be backed with hard evidence. And finally, this week, a team of astronomers at the Bicep 2 telescope in the South Pole announced the discovery of gravitational waves supporting inflation theory, a theory that hypothesizes the initial and continued expansion of the universe. What's more is that the discovery of these quantum gravitational waves, which are probably best described as tremors or aftershocks of the Big Bang, also provides evidence supporting Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity. Now imagine for a moment these gravitational waves ripping through an expanding universe in less than a trillionth of a second, following the biggest explosion in the history of time and space, galaxies, stars, planets, and life itself. Left in its wake. And in this inflation, there's room for multiple universes spanning distances beyond the ability of the human mind to even fathom. Now, there will be much scrutiny against the findings of these astronomers as their discovery remains uncorroborated by another party just yet. But that's just the nature of science, to prove and disprove theories and make the best guess we can at answering the mysteries of life, the universe, and everything. Stick around, we'll break down the disaster that was the Iraq War with a former soldier who was there.
For their profits. Based on the last month, jerky, they're not American.
Believe it or not, Americans consume more meat than almost every other country on Earth, barely trailing behind Luxembourg. And it seems like every day I hear about another massive recall of meat. This week, Crave Jerky's beef in Petaluma, California is the latest loss being recalled in mass due to safety concerns. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, Petaluma Slaughterhouse Rancho Feeding Corp. stopped operating last month after a series of recalls, most recent involving 8.7 million pounds of beef, a year's worth of meat that has been processed from diseased and unhealthy animals without a full federal inspection. Wow, a full year's worth of beef, and how many thousands of cows had to die for nothing? You know, all this enormous waste of meat just brings us to yet another issue. How come all these recalls aren't impacting the meat industry's bottom line? One would think that constantly incurring such enormous setbacks would be horrific for their profits. But it all makes a little more sense when you realize that when it comes to the free market of the meat industry, the government plays by a whole different set of rules. See, instead of offering federal subsidies to help struggling organic vegetable and fruit farmers, you know, the things that we should actually be cultivating and promoting, there's a corrupt federal subsidy system that gives billions in handouts to massive ag business, which in turn churns out a fast food industrial complex of low-grade, unhealthy food. According to Reason Magazine, the government also spends millions of dollars bailing out its meat industry cohorts, having stepped in to purchase $100 million in pork during a drought, and another buyout of $30 million during the swine flu scare. But despite these handouts, the industry continues to fight the government tooth and nail against the many animal protection regulations. Yes, more than 90% of farm animals in the U.S. are raised in utterly deplorable conditions, from being castrated without anesthetics to being forced to live in tiny cages unable to turn around until the day they die. But it's not just the animals that are suffering. It's humans, too.
Right now, two-thirds of American citizens are either overweight or obese, and a huge contributing factor is the consumption of factory farm meat and dairy, not to mention diabetes, high blood pressure, and heart disease. According to CNN, a report by the Union of Concerned Scientists states that 100,000 lives could be saved, along with $17 billion in health care costs, if only more Americans ate healthy foods, like fruit and vegetables. Not to mention the environment is also hugely affected by America's addiction to meat. And beyond just the U.S., the U.N. cites global meat production as a contributor to almost a quarter of the world's greenhouse gases. The unhealthy nature of an absurd practice of subsidizing meat keeps the prices artificially low, making fast food the cheaper alternative to poor working class families. So, what can we do about it? Well, a couple months ago, I spoke to Grammy-nominated artist Moby, who's a vegan and staunch animal rights activist, about what he thinks the solution should be.
The production of meat, it decimates the animals, it decimates the workers, it decimates the communities, and the end result is a product that causes diabetes, arteriosclerosis, heart disease, obesity, etc. So just end all subsidies to it and let meat actually cost what it should cost. Because the truth is, without government subsidies, a pound of hamburger would cost around $30. And I have a feeling if you just let meat cost what it should cost, all of a sudden you'd see people eating a lot less meat.
What a concept, letting meat cost what it should and letting the chips fall where they may. Because if people only knew what the meat industry was doing to the animals, the environment, and the health of humanity, something tells me there would be more than one veggie option on the average dinner menu.
Why aren't people going to jail?
There are tons of reporters and politicians that have left the mainstream establishment for various reasons, some to be more independent, unbiased, and unpressured from their industries. And there are some people who march to the beat of their own drummers and not only leave, but go completely off the grid. And that's exactly what former Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura has done. See, for now, he's over living in the U.S. and has opted for happier, more tranquil days to escape the NSA and surveillance drones soon to be flying over our heads. Where is he? We don't know, but we were still able to snag him for an interview earlier today. I first asked him to tell us about his new show on Aura TV called Off the Grid and what topics he's covering that can't be covered in American media.
Well, Off the Grid is the fact that I feel I'm being censored in the United States. I did a book tour last time, and I couldn't get on Fox News. I couldn't get on MSNBC. I couldn't get on any of the networks whatsoever. And so this idea came up to put me on the Internet. I did an interview with Larry King, and Larry, as you know, has left CNN and is part of Aura.tv, and he said, this is where you need to be. And I explained to them that the problem was I had made a life choice about 7-8 years ago to live off the grid 4 months out of the year, and they said, we have the technology. That's not a problem. We can do it anywhere. And so then it thus became the show, where I now talk from the outside looking in as opposed to the inside looking out where I was before, and maybe I'll have a better effect on waking people up, and the fact that it's on the Internet, so it's no holds barred. I can talk about anything I want, and the subjects are mine and mine alone.
You've talked about how you left the U.S. also so you can get away from the drones circling overhead. How serious of a concern do you think domestic drones really pose for the future of this country?
Well, you know, I made light of it. It was tongue-in-cheek because, you know, mainstream media is just begging to be made fun of. You know, they truly are. They're just begging, make fun of us, make fun of us, because they deserve it. So I say things and they run with it, not like, you know, that we're down here dodging the drones and that. But when you look at it on a serious note, it's exceptionally serious. I mean, when our Constitution and our Bill of Rights get violated by the government, why aren't people going to jail for that, or at least losing their jobs? You know, people talk about Snowden, and they say, well, he broke a contract, and he revealed this. The point is, the Constitution and Bill of Rights are the highest law of the land. They take precedence over anything else. And so that's under assault right now. Our government is operating like they've suspended the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, which is ridiculous. You can't do that unless you declare martial law. But it seems we have an undeclared martial law, and that's what the essence of everything is to take back our country and get back the freedoms that we've lost since 9/11.
Jesse, you've grown up, you know, through the Cold War, Vietnam. You've been in the military. You have family that's been in the military. You know, you talk about how the U.S. almost is like an undeclared martial law. In what ways do you think it resembles East Berlin, which is what you compared it to in another interview?
Yeah, because, I mean, I cross the border every year, and it's ridiculous. If I cross at Mexico, there's nobody there. I've actually stopped my vehicle, rolled the windows down, and say, doesn't somebody at least hand me a piece of paper and say, buenos dias? No, they welcome me because guess what? I bring pesos. They know I'm going to spend money down here. They like having me down here. I create jobs. You know I'm a job creator now? I'm creating these jobs down here, and now these illegals won't have to cross the border to pick strawberries and take your job.
Wait. Are you being facetious here? Do you really think that Mexicans are coming and stealing American jobs? Would Americans really be wanting to pick strawberries, Jesse?
Yes, because all my guys, the people that work for me, have told me unequivocally. They said, Governor, if I wasn't employed with you on Off the Grid, I would be over the border right now illegally. So there you go. I'm on the job solving illegal immigration and being a job creator. Of course I'm having fun with that. But it's true. It's just on a small level.
Well, do you support amnesty for actually the millions of undocumented immigrants currently living and working in the U.S.?
I support something more than that. Call me crazy. I support taking down borders. I support that we're all human beings on this planet, and why should I have to produce paperwork when I want to go somewhere? How's that one?
I like that a lot, Jesse. I think that we're both internationalists, and I think borders are extremely destructive. And the language of, you know, I'm American, you're this, you're that, gives you some sort of moral authority to do harm and destruction. It couldn't be more damaging, Jesse. I couldn't agree with you more. Let's move on to another issue that you're... Continue.
Well, what's worse, if you see a big fence with barbed wire on the top and you see someone on the other side of that fence, immediately you suspect them of being something bad, something negative, because you have this man-made fence between you.
I wanted to bring up another interesting idea that you've promoted, abolishing the income tax, transitioning to a national sales tax. Really fascinating. Can you really briefly explain how that would work and would reduce the massive inequality levels?
Well, what it would do, it would make you the, first and foremost, it would make you the citizen number one again. You'd get your money first. Now, through the current income tax, you get your money second. The government gets it first. So they're number one. You'd get the gross on your check. You know, that fictitious number. What is that number? Well, you'd get that number because you would decide what you paid taxes on by what you purchase. Now, you can still have a safety net. You can declare that, you know, for poverty people, they get their, hypothetically, their first $10,000 purchases free of charge. But anything beyond that, they pay. And you pay at the point of purchase. So therefore, as citizens, you would never face the Internal Revenue again. You could reverse the Internal Revenue's role and have them watchdogging business to government to ensure our taxes are properly being used. Never again would I have to keep books for 7 years fearing an audit. And if you decided this week you didn't want to pay taxes, you wouldn't have to. Don't buy anything. See, my belief is, core belief is this. Wealth is not determined by what you make. It's determined by what you earn, by what you spend. Because if you make $1 million a year, but you live in a studio apartment and drive a beat-up Volkswagen, you're hardly living like a millionaire. Now, when you buy the Mercedes, the yacht, well, then you're living like a millionaire and you'll be taxed as such. And it would also mean the government would have to base everything of their operation on our national economy. Because if the economy would falter, we wouldn't buy anything and the government wouldn't get paid off.
Jesse, it seems like a genius concept. I wonder why it hasn't gained more traction, because it's totally true. And then people who are in poverty, they would just not have to take half of their earnings given to the federal government to perpetuate the war machine. I mean, they can just go out and spend what they want to contribute to society. It just sounds so smart.
And the thing is, you don't have to tax food. That's an essence of life. Clothing. anything under $150, no tax. You start buying mink stoles, yeah, there's a tax on that. If you buy food, if you buy clothing that's more than $150. But, I mean, anybody can buy jeans, you can buy underwear, you can buy your socks, and you won't get taxed. And it would all be based on our gross national product. And it would only need to be about 12%. You're telling me our government can't run off 12% of the gross national product? If they can't, then it's time to replace them.
Well, it sounds way too reasonable for anyone in this government to be supporting, Jesse. That's why you and I are talking about it, I guess.
Albie, that's why I'm off the grid.
You have the right, you've made the right moves, Jesse. I wanted to really quickly, I know that you've talked about this kind of Cold War resurrection, and I just can't let you go without addressing it. I know that you dedicated one of the off the grids to discussing this. I mean, I just feel, I mean, I can't imagine how you feel actually living through the Cold War and then seeing us go back. How do you think the situation is going to play out, and how can we stop this fear-mongering and war-mongering in terms of Russia versus the U.S. right now?
The frustration is nobody is paying attention to history. It's that simple. And that old cliche, if you don't read your history, you're doomed to repeat it. Trust me, it's happening in decades now, not just in lifetimes. People, start reading your history. People, start studying what has gone on in the last 50 years, and you see it repeated over and over and over again. What's that other cliche about being crazy, right?
Einstein, if you repeat the same thing and expect different results, I mean, that's the definition of insanity.
Yeah, there you go. You're insane. And yet we've got this insanity going on. We're doing the same thing, and I'm seeing it now within decades. And I'm only 62. You know, I still consider mentally I'm about 24. You know, it's just chronologically I'm 62, but I'm sitting here looking in my lifetime, having lived through the Cold War, and saying we're going to let these morons erect the Cold War again when it was all fictitious to begin with. They were telling their people this story, and behind the Iron Curtain, we were telling our people this story on this side of the Iron Curtain, and both sides were getting lied to.
Yeah. I mean, you know that it's desperate when the war machine reverts back to that Cold War propaganda. I hope people are smart enough to realize what's going on, Jesse. Rise up. Stop it once and for all. Thank you so much for coming on.
Coming up, we'll take a look at why CNN's ratings have soared over the last week.
Might be familiar with the Zeitgeist movement. It's a grassroots initiative that's widely regarded as one of the most transformative social movements on the planet. Well, over the weekend, the global community of activists attended the 6th annual Zeitgeist Day, or Z-Day, with its main event hosted at the University of Toronto. Z-Day provides a platform for thousands of people around the world to discuss some of the most important issues facing global society. And while specific discussions change every year, the end goal remains the same: shifting public consciousness to embrace and enact paradigm-shifting solutions. Earlier today, I was joined by Ben McLeish, a speaker at Z-Day 2014 and contributor to a new book titled The Zeitgeist Movement Defined. I first asked Ben how the movement has evolved since its first Z-Day.
It's been a very organic transition as people have started to hear about it more. So we've certainly seen a groundswell in membership, different diverse people from different backgrounds, not just what you would call the traditional activist types. And we've also seen a fair amount of buy-in from what you term famous people, people who have of celebrity who are interested in positively affecting the world.
And you were giving a talk at this year's event about paradigm shifts, Ben. Can you expand on the notion that we are in the midst of a new emerging social paradigm?
Yes, paradigms are very powerful precisely because they are an interlocking set of ideas that seem to support themselves. They always claim that they refer to science and the real world and the way things really are. You can see quite clearly how ridiculous this is when you go back and see that we used to believe in toothworms for almost 4,000 years with no physical evidence whatsoever, or the divine right of kings back when we thought that kingship needed to be justified that way. All of these things are always claimed to be absolutely natural. The paradigm we find ourselves in now is probably the most dangerous one because it's certainly a mode of behavior on the planet that doesn't take into account at all the resources that are actually there. We assume that it's completely infinite. And we're still very much on a centralized ownership and control-based model, and really decentralized And open and available models are really what we're transitioning towards, and which are the most stable, the most sustainable, and include, by definition, the most people possible.
I've discussed the Zeitgeist movement before with its founder, Peter Joseph, on this show, but can you describe really briefly for our audience what a resource-based economy is? And you're talking about the transition and the importance of one. How can we transition from this paradigm into a resource-based economy?
Sure. So a resource-based economy, quite simply, is an economy that explicitly uses the best in science and technology for the welfare and concern of humanity and the biosphere. It's a remarkable fact that the modern paradigm, whatever you want to call it, whether you want to use the snarl word capitalism or anything else, simply doesn't take this stuff into account. So it's a deliberate worldwide understanding of our interconnected nature on this planet, the fact that we do have a planet to live on, and it is, for all intents and purposes, a closed system that we have to maximize in and have to really look after the resources. And that includes things like replenishment rates. It includes basic human needs being serviced and looked after and served in general by the society. And the only way to really do that, to follow real efficiency rather than the sort of market efficiency of profit maximization that we see at the moment, is ultimately in the most important sense, going to yield a moneyless society once we really get to functional utility of things. So that's the general overview of it. To get there, well, you can't do it without education. You can't do this to a room full of blank stares and minds that have not been organized to understand what is actually important in life, why we do actually prefer science and technology in, it seems, everything except things like religion and economics. These things seem to be somehow not in line with it.
You're talking about open source technology, things like that. You've cited Wikipedia in the past as an example of what humans can accomplish when information is free. But even Wikipedia is governed by mob rule. So who would make the decisions in a resource-based economy?
It's not so much that we want to make decisions. It's that these decisions become arrived at. There's actually a very decent writer called Clay Shirky who wrote a good book called Here Comes Everybody that describes organization without organizations and describes how essentially as a matter of creating a decentralized, open source, and available system for anybody who wants to participate, you can mass organize information and create byproducts that essentially don't mean that you have to put anything to a vote. It's sort of a byproduct of the system itself, the integrity and the correlation of each individual to the other and the availability of information on a mass scale that actually allows you to arrive at decisions very quickly. We do this now. I mean, nobody sits and tries to work out where the bandwidth of the internet should go tomorrow. It's something that through load balancing and intelligent feedback systems and almost approaching sort of neural network idea of artificial intelligence is something that is essentially produced out of the system functioning correctly.
I just wanted to get this out of the way. For those who think that the Zeitgeist movement is Marx's ideal, is the utopia of Marxism, can you explain why it's not?
Sure. The end goal of the Zeitgeist movement is not to exist anymore. We want to create a world that no longer requires the basic advocation and the delivery of understandings of why science and technology form the cornerstone of anything that's good about your life and about the life around you. And this has not been the case with any of the sort of so-called political movements of the past that want to see a sort of a thousand-year rule or any kind of permanent installation of their particular ideologies. We don't peddle in ideologies at all. We peddle in rationality and wanting people to finally think for themselves and not immediately knee-jerk and say, well, who do I vote for to get this in? You can't vote for anybody. There's no person that will do this for you. This is the byproduct of you understanding that the idea of voting for a human or a set of humans amid a systems-governed world is itself an act of irrationality, is itself corruption.
Ben, you collaborated on a book that just came out called The Zeitgeist Movement Defined. It's also available as an e-book. Can you talk about what the book is all about?
Sure, I've got a copy of it here. What we did, and it was after many years of requests, is that we've spent the best part of about 3 years really compiling the front-to-back train of thought from where we are now presently with economics, what actually is important, the various understandings of things like systems theory, and again, we talk about paradigms a lot, all the way through to the fundamental building blocks of how one might approach building a society on the planet that really is in line with the natural world that we see and that would maximize not just the biosphere, not just humanity, but indeed both. And we put that all together in an extended set of essays, fully referenced, many, many hundreds of sources are in there. So if anybody is finding themselves blankly staring at the screen, not really understanding what I'm saying, our book is available completely for free on our website, or there's an at-cost available order from things like Amazon and Lulu.
Thank you so much, Ben McLeish, speaker, Zeitgeist Movement. Really appreciate you coming on. That's our show, you guys. Good night.
This week on Vice, Greenland is melting.
This is a crime scene that is so covered in our fingerprints.
There it goes!
Then, escaping from modern-day slavery in Pakistan.
Once you get someone in, they can never leave.
We're here on the southern lobe of the Greenland ice sheet. It's melting at such an alarming rate. Extreme weather events have been in the news a lot lately. Hurricanes, tornadoes, superstorms, and prolonged drought are not only becoming increasingly commonplace, but tragically, increasingly destructive. However, perhaps the biggest threat humanity faces as the Earth continues to warm is sea level rise. In the last few years, Greenland has hit its highest temperatures in recorded history. It has also experienced the first full surface melt of its ice sheets in our modern era. Now, these two events have so much potential impact on the world's oceans that many scientists have become quite concerned. So we went to Greenland to see what's happening on the front lines of climate change. So right now, we've been coming in through an old 1930s glacier boat up the waterway to the actual glacier front to see all the icebergs. And being a guy who watched Titanic, I'm like, isn't it stupid to go near icebergs? But we're going right into a sort of iceberg field, which is a bit odd. You can see here he's actually pushing the iceberg. Greenland's glaciers are in free fall. Every year, Greenland loses over 140 billion tons of ice. This net ice loss is now responsible for a significant amount of our current global sea level rise. Now, some of the fastest and most alarming melts are occurring on the country's western coast, where many glaciers meet the warmer ocean waters, causing massive icebergs to break off from Greenland's ice sheet in a process known as calving. To witness some of these events firsthand, we met up with one of the world's leading experts on Greenland's ice sheets, Dr. Jason Box. In his role as glaciologist for the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland, Dr. Box has unique insight into the data and science that helps us understand Greenland's glaciers and the factors that are causing the extreme melt there. Our route out to the ice sheet took us directly over some newly deglaciated land. Now, this area would have been totally covered in ice up until recently, but because of the melt, we had to fly fully 5 miles further inland just to reach the glacier itself.
Just 10 years ago, much of what you see here was covered in several hundred feet of ice.
Wow. So all this is brand new. This is all freshly deglaciated, so we've had the glacier retreat.
Yeah. Just this region here has lost enough ice to supply Los Angeles with fresh water for about 2,000 years.
Wow.
It's hard to put numbers on this that aren't astronomical.
When you first see it, the ice sheet itself seems to go on forever. And in many places, it's miles and miles thick. It's then you realize just how much water is tied up in it, because the ice sheet covers about 80% of Greenland, which in turn is about three times the size of Texas.
We're here on the southern lobe of the Greenland ice sheet with Dr. Jason Box to actually measure how fast the ice sheet is melting, because it's melting at such an alarming rate.
Yeah, okay, they're 2 meters.
How much will this shelf melt in the next year?
This site's been melting more than anywhere in Greenland at the surface. Last year, we measured 9 meters.
9 meters.
9 meters of melting. So that's, you know, like 27 feet of ice melt. You know, the size of a house is this how much is...
In 1 year.
Yeah.
So Dr. Box is going to put the pole down into the ice. So if you can see all the way up to there, that's how much ice on this shelf is melting every year.
Dr. Box's method to track ice melt here is actually really simple. After drilling down into the ice, he places a long 30-foot pole into the ice shelf and leaves it there. When he comes back in a year, he measures how much of the pole has been revealed. Now, the ice on this glacier is melting so fast that the flag you see here will be 27 feet higher in the air in just 12 months. One of the reasons the ice is melting so quickly is visible right on the surface. Contrary to what I thought before traveling to Greenland, the ice sheets are not actually vast expanses of gleaming white ice and snow, because due to increased pollution and airborne soot, the ice is actually very dirty. Now, this dirty or dark ice accelerates melt because its color absorbs the heat rather than reflect it.
So you can see that the dark ice here is melting down. Why does that happen?
Well, the dark material absorbs about 3 times more sunlight than if it weren't here, and that's why it's melting more here locally. There's always been some dark material on the surface, but we think that there should be more if wildfire is increasing, and that is documented.
The soot comes by air to here.
Yeah, the question is if climate warming creates more fire, that's going to be depositing more light-absorbing material on the ice.
And it's sort of cyclical. The hotter it gets, the more fires. The more fires, the more soot, the more soot, the more dark ice, the more dark ice, the more...
Rising global temperatures are making the natural fire season not only much longer, but also much drier, which in turn leads to more soot and therefore more black ice. And another contributor is the massive amount of industrial pollution that is carried to Greenland by air currents. These particles land, then literally drill down into the ice, thereby exacerbating the whole process.
You can see the hole goes all the way down there.
Yeah, and then it looks like this fracture here. It may have been that the water filled up and then forced this crack open. We call it hydrofracture, and that's when water drains down into the cracks.
Yeah.
Because water is heavier than ice, and it actually can force the cracks open.
The meltwater actually hydrofracts down into the interior of a glacier and lubricates the entire glacier from within, causing it to break apart and calve into the sea.
Then the next thing is, okay, how fast is it melting, and,
right.
and how quickly would that contribute to sea level rise?
Right.
Climate change has outpaced the worst-case scenarios that was observed 20 years ago. And so it's just melting as fast as it can here.
If all of Greenland melts, how much would the ocean rise?
Well, Greenland contains about 7 meters or 21 feet of global sea level equivalent.
21 feet?
Yeah.
So if it melted... 21 feet.
So just to be clear on what that means, if all of Greenland's ice melts, which is now being argued as a distinct scientific possibility, then 80 of the world's 100 biggest cities would be underwater. To illustrate his point, Dr. Box took us to see what sea level rise looks like in real time.
Now we're heading to the ice front where it's calving. Here's where the ice is going really fast, like several kilometers per year. And this is like kind of like a sports car glacier.
That's right.
It's very steep, and it's just shoving a lot of ice into the sea. It looks like the palace of Jor-El.
Yeah.
Superman threw his Krypton in there, and it...
Yeah, it became the Fortress of Solitude.
Fortress of Solitude.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. That is wild. That's amazing. Oh, shit. Yeah, that whole front is going to come off there.
Go. There it goes. Holy fuck. Whoa.
Look at how much the water is.
Yeah, that's it, man.
an apartment building just fell over.
Wow.
A lot of this water that's bubbling up in the front.
Yeah.
That's another part of the story, because that turbulent water is forcing a heat exchange between this warm ocean and the cold ice.
Right.
So that mixing, that's actually forced by meltwater, squirting out at depth, and then it rises because the fresh water is lighter. It's undercutting it and promoting calving.
One thing that's hard to describe about what's happening in Greenland is the scale of it all. For example, these ice cliffs are hundreds and hundreds of feet high, and they are continually calving into the sea.
Look at that. That's crazy. Wow, look at that.
Dr. Block suggested we set up camp next to the glacier to witness just how fast it's breaking apart.
Sounds like there's a thunderstorm going on right now, but it's odd because it's not coming from the sky, it's coming from below us. Literally, whole mountains, thousands of tons of ice are just falling into the sea or the fjord as we are talking by the fire about climate change. It's pretty sobering. It scares the piss out of me, quite frankly. If you look at the latest data, we're 60 years ahead of the worst case scenario. That worst case scenario is staggering. So what happens if 80 years from now we're 60 years ahead of those worst case scenarios like we are today? Then we're in a catastrophic situation.
Well, that seems likely because the trajectory that we're on right now is toward climate catastrophe. There does reach a point where it becomes unmanageable.
Now, the worst case scenarios Dr. Box and I were talking about were based on the recently released Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC's, fifth report, which concludes that we have dramatically exceeded our previous worst-case scenarios. Now, in order to understand what the findings of the latest IPCC report really mean, and to make sense of what we had just seen in Greenland firsthand, we wanted to talk to someone who could give us a consensus of what the global scientific community thinks about these issues. So we contacted Dr. Gavin Schmidt, a climatologist at NASA and a well-respected voice in the oftentimes contentious dialogue that surrounds climate change.
So the IPCC5 report just came out, which shows that we're well ahead of worst-case scenarios that we had from the past decade. Can you give us some context of what is going on?
Change in the Arctic sea ice is way ahead, again, of the predictions that we made even 5 years ago. You know, we have sea level rise coming from the melt on Greenland. We have more sea level rise coming from glaciers in mountains around the world that are melting. We have more melt coming from West Antarctica. And then we've got the warming of the oceans. We're pouring effectively enormous amounts of heat into the oceans year on, year out. And that's causing the oceans to expand. All of those things add up to the sea level rise that we're seeing, and we anticipate that that's going to accelerate over the next 50, 100 years. To slow down the current rate of sea level rise, we need to stabilize glaciers and Greenland and stop adding so much heat into the system. We need to cut emissions of mainly carbon dioxide by about 80%.
80%.
80%.
So we have to cut emissions by 80% in the next...
in the next few decades.
What happens if we don't?
Well, then we're talking about a scenario where sea level rise is accelerating. It could reach levels by the end of the century of 4, perhaps 5, perhaps more feet, and then it will continue on.
And our emissions are going up, not down.
And our emissions are going up, not down.
How much of this crisis is man-made?
All of it. We look for the fingerprints of change that are associated with the sun or from volcanoes or from natural variability in the ocean. And we look for each of those fingerprints and they don't match. This is a crime scene that is so covered in our fingerprints, there is no credible way that you can say it was somebody else.
but it's not going to stop. Even if we stabilize temperatures, we'd still be seeing sea level rise continue for centuries to thousands of years.
So even if we stop, sea level rise is going to continue. It just hopefully is going to slow down.
That would be the hope.
What happens if, going forward, we keep beating our predictions?
Well, then we're talking about a scenario where cities like Shanghai, New York, Calcutta, all of these places are going to have to either retreat from the coast or build barriers to protect themselves. And if you're not in a city that can afford that, you're going to be out of luck. Those cities are just going to more and more disappear.
Now, this would all be bad enough if it were just Greenland. But now, Antarctica, the largest deposit of ice in the world, is starting to experience large amounts of net ice melt as well. What happens if Antarctica and the Arctic start melting at the same rates as Greenland?
West Antarctica, we're seeing very rapid changes there. So it could well be that Antarctica will start to melt at the same rate as Greenland is.
If Antarctica starts melting at the same rate as Greenland, we're in for trouble.
Indeed. Sea level rise is the one problem where there are no winners. Now, if you have a change in rain patterns, if you have a change in temperature, you know, somebody might be able to benefit from that. Sea level rise, nobody wins.
Hard walking in and filling the shoes of that introduction this morning, but I stand on the shoulders being held by literally tens of thousands of volunteers, of former staff who are out in the satellite cities, of donors, of dreamers, of people who've held the same vision and made it possible for so much to happen. So thank you. Thank you. This is a celebration this morning of your dreams, your work, your support. Mike, thank you. My goal today is to take us to support you and all of us moving to the next level. We have been doing Bioneers for a lot of years. We have been hearing great solutions. You need to know it's the right stuff. But we need support. The question is always hanging out there, are our small steps enough? We know how vulnerable we are. We know how small we are in the face of the magnitude of global destruction. It's very easy to think, I'm not it. I can't do it. I'm too little. I'm too weak. I'm too scared. My goal today is for you to see, know, validate that your vision is right, your antennas are working, and to encourage you to keep those tuned in and to start responding, to gird up your loins, to put your oxygen mask on first, because the pressure is going to change in this cabin. It has. And seriously, you look out there, you heard Nina's words this morning. It hurts. It's scary. It's real. I'm actually going to throw away a bunch of my script today because she set up the change for me to do a little bit more and different. It's so important that we move into action now as this conference moves to a close. Thank you. As we move with strength from this network of community and incredible love and support, it's important that we start having the strength to move forward and know that we can. But just as that notion of putting on the oxygen mask, it's not selfish. You are needed. You are needed badly. You need to be strong and you need to be set and ready to go. By putting that oxygen mask on first, you have the ability to help others. People in New Orleans were surprised when they got hit. The global changes are amongst us. It's not going to calm down for a while. We're needed. And we can do it. The story I'm going to tell you today is intended to give you some more strength and more confidence that the change is well underway, but it's not all, none of it's off life support. You're all needed to keep it going and to spread it. So Kenny did me the favor of telling you a bunch of the story that I don't need to now tell you of getting started as a kid. But a lot of people, including myself, discounted the impact of our work of just planting one tree at a time. And we did a lot of tree planting. We learned a lot about bringing people together. Our work wasn't just to restore the forest. It was to re-knit the fabric of community, to turn people onto their power. And we got pretty successful at that. About 15 years into the work, LA got hit by actually an early sign of climate change, and nobody knew that it was. It was a 100-year flood in 1978, and then again another one in 1980. I tell you this story because it's really similar to what happened a few weeks ago in New Orleans. LA's communication systems broke. Police fire radios didn't work in the canyons. Massive floods and mudslides started. Tree people used its skill, its tools for planting. We got volunteers together, and we sandbagged homes and saved a few. The city noticed, and when the storms got worse, they asked us if we could get more volunteers involved. And what we did was go to the media and ask them to ask people if they would volunteer. Now, it's really important to understand that we don't use volunteers much in emergencies anymore. If we have a fire in Los Angeles, we'll fly firefighters in from the other side of the country before we'll use volunteers. But in this case, things were desperate. People were calling the fire department for help and being told, sorry, we can't get there. You're on your own. So who showed up was ham radio operators, four-wheel drive clubs with Kill Sierra Clubbers on their bumper stickers, environmentalists, construction workers, and we assembled them into an army. We did fast training, put people in teams, and because our communications was so good, the fire department, police department established a hotline right into our offices. Anytime they got an emergency dispatch, they just picked it up, gave it to us, and we could radio out. We wound up re-knitting the radio communication network in Los Angeles. I tell you that because the same thing happened in New Orleans. But because, as we heard over the last few days, we have been so infantilized, so much turned into consumers, therefore victims, people weren't able to respond. They didn't know that they could, and they weren't even allowed to. We put together this emergency network, and it worked. In 1980, over 10 days' time, 3,000 volunteers saved 1,200 homes and rescued people. So having done that, it made me think that we could do more, and that's when we started a campaign to plant 1 million trees before the Olympics in 1980, and we did that. And then we moved on. We got, after being really good at getting trees planted, communities together, people dreaming, people taking to the streets, reclaiming their communities, and successfully greening them, LA got hit by a major indicator that our work wasn't working. It was the Rodney King riots. And I was really heartbroken and despondent. It's like 20 years of doing this, it's not working. And people said to me, well, what does that have to do with your work? You can't use that as an indicator. You're just planting trees. I said, we're planting trees to feed people. We're planting trees to improve the quality of life, create a sense of justice and power. And obviously, the pain is still so great, with poverty, with racism, with inequality, that we're not getting the job done. And I started reading Paul Hawkins' work and trying to learn, and did. Started looking for, where are we hemorrhaging resources? Where is the pain? Why? Why is the pain? And began to see that we were living in one of the most unsustainable ecosystems, that we were hemorrhaging resources. We tried to get money and did, after the riots, by one federal agency. But all the sociologists studying Los Angeles said to mitigate the pain and prevent another riot, we needed to create 50,000 new jobs for urban youth. who are basically being warehoused in the landfill of our inner cities. And that would cost, no one said what the cost would be, but I checked it out. It would cost about $500 million a year to create and sustain 50,000 new jobs. Well, guess what? That seemed like way too much money, not really worth it, and it didn't ever happen. But I began to look for that $500 million, and I started to find it everywhere I turned. Suddenly, a federal agency showed up in town with $500 million. It was the Army Corps of Engineers. They had a project to fix LA after the riots. It actually had nothing to do with the riots. It had to do with the fact that we had so overpaved the city. Now two-thirds of Los Angeles is paved. So when it rains, all the water runs off, and it threatens a flood that will take out the southern half of the city. So they decided to raise the walls of the LA River. The river had been already turned into a storm drain, but they had to put the effect of levees on it so we could repeat what happened in New Orleans. No, it's supposedly to prevent that. And I thought, that's nuts. We need the water. We're going to send more polluted water to the ocean and make things worse. And it wasn't going to create jobs. So I looked around and said, well, we need the water. I went to our water supply agency and found out that they spend $1 billion a year to bring water into Los Angeles. $1 billion. Amazing. I said, well, we need more water. We hear there's shortages. There's a lot of water here. In fact, the rainfall we receive is half the water we need in Los Angeles. But we throw almost all of it away. I said, well, if we could capture it, that would be great. Because I also learned that they were going to be spending billions more to bring water from here and other parts of the western United States, really despoiling these ecosystems, hurting the bay, the fish. And they said, you know, that's really nice, but it's a lot cheaper for us to build canals and bring the water from Sacramento, San Francisco, Montana, Utah, Colorado, Nevada. And no, we're not going to do that. It doesn't make economic sense. So I've looked further and found that we have a county flood control agency whose job it was to work with the Army Corps and get rid of that water and said, hey, you know, there's a better way than putting in more concrete. We could actually get the water in the ground and clean up the water. And they said, yeah, but you'd have to, oh, I left off. I saw that other countries like Australia and other places capture their water in cisterns, manage the land a little better, and shepherd that precious resource. I said, we could put in cisterns. We could capture the water. In fact, it works perfectly in a forest. And if we did urban forestry and urban watershed management, this would work great. And they said, yeah, but it's too expensive. And you'd have to capture the equivalent of a 20,000-gallon swimming pool on 1 million homes in Los Angeles for it to work. So forget it. It's not going to happen. Leave us alone. I actually went out debating the colonel from the Army Corps with business groups trying to build support for this notion. People did think I was crazy. He would get up in front of the room in his uniform and say, I'm with the Army Corps. Our mission is to keep water and people apart and to protect you. From the boogie flood. I would then get up in front of the room and say, well, I'm with tree people. Our mission... Our mission is to inspire people to take personal responsibility for the environment and to participate in its healing. And people went, okay. Well, they didn't do that. You know, Army, big stuff, won the day in the face of fear. It got to the point where we actually challenged the environmental impact report at the County Board of Supervisors and said, there's a better way. Only one supervisor believed us. He couldn't get a second to stop the process. When that hearing was over, the wall project was approved. The money was about to be spent. The head of county flood control came out of the hearing and said, Andy, you did the flood work. You've been a friend. I don't know why you're so angry at us. You got 40 miles of wall to plant trees in front of. And I said, Carl, and parents, you might want to cover your kids' ears here. Carl. We're not here to plant your fucking walls. And decorate your walls and make it look pretty. We're here to plant trees to heal this city. We'll see you in court. We joined Heal the Bay. Friends of the LA River went to court. It didn't work. They didn't understand. I got hit with the same problem I often get hit with, being a bit of a visionary and an artist, is I see what some people don't yet see. So I turned left and convinced the Forest Service to give us a challenge grant, which then triggered more money to come to build a project to demonstrate that it was technically and economically feasible to retrofit the city to function as living ecosystem, as a forest, as a watershed. And we got the money, and we did a few things. We brought 100 of the best minds in architecture, landscape architecture, and engineering to Los Angeles, spent 4 days together, challenged them to design how to retrofit the city so it could work. They came up with specific engineering and architecture and landscape architecture designs. These people battled, and they're used to battling each other. We held what's called a charrette, an integrated design workshop. We held their feet to the fire with really great facilitators. And after 4 days, they came through with brilliant designs. We took one of them and we applied it to a house in South Los Angeles. And at that house, after we built it, we invited all the government agencies back, including the guy, Carl Bloom, head of flood control. And we held a flash flood. We dumped 4,000 gallons of water on the house in about 5 minutes. We did give them umbrellas first. And magically, the water flowed from the roofs into cisterns, flowed from the roofs instead of down the, well, hold your applause, down the driveway, picking up the pollution and going to the street. We just bent the downspouts and sent the water into the lawn where we had put berms around them so they could hold about 5,000 gallons of flood water. Miraculously, oh, and we filled it with mulch. None of that water leaked to the street. And it opened people's minds to integration in a way that was really startling. Carl Bloom said his mind was spinning. He took our, so we did the design work, and we also then had 200 agency scientists and economists spend 2 years together working to do the economics. We hired the Army Corps' most conservative economics firm to manage it. The result was an incredible document that showed that we could, in fact, create those jobs. We could get, if agencies would work together, we could stack up enough money to do the retrofit. In fact, LA was going to spend $20 billion in disintegrated projects. If it was spent, integrated, collaborated, it was enough to fix the city. So we got that document down. And we gave that to Carl Bloom after that our flash flood. And he called me 3 days later and said, "I'm sorry. We didn't understand. We think you've cracked it." He said, "Our difference now is about time and maybe about money. Andy, you say it'll take 15 years to retrofit LA. I know it's going to take 50, but we have to start today, and we got to blow up your simple house to a whole-scale watershed, and I have a project for you. If our engineers can duplicate your work, we just froze a $50 million storm drain so we could try your project." Hold your applause. Let me roll through this. He said, "Who do we need to bring to the table?" We brought together a team, and then we launched. Said, "Let's give it a try." Took 2 years of feasibility study. They said, "Yep, it'll work." We then launched a 4-year watershed planning process, including an environmental impact report. Last June, both of those were approved by the County Board of Supervisors, including a $200 million budget to build it. Now, you wonder why $200 million when it was only a $50 million storm drain. Because the amount of water we're capturing, putting back in the ground, the amount of savings in the Department of Sanitation for not having to pick up green waste and haul it to the landfill was close to $300 million. There at the table, we have begun construction, and now I'm going to show you slides of what this stuff looks like.
Thank you. I just wanted you to see LA's footprint, LA's broader watershed. That, I don't have my laser pointer. All those green zones are where we suck water from in order to water our lawns and flush our toilets and do various things in Los Angeles. It's unacceptable and it's unnecessary. Our goal is to reduce LA's water use by half, and we think we can get there. This is what it looks like when it rains in LA. A half an inch of rainfall generates a lot of runoff, billions of gallons. What I encountered, and I don't know if you can read that, was the disintegration. These different circles are different agencies in the city. There's actually a lot more. But when you look at the city as an ecosystem, you begin to see how they're interrelated. There is nobody in charge at any level of government who looks at it as ecosystem, who does integration. And so we have disintegration. And our cities are disintegrating. We're hemorrhaging resources. Our people are hurting. Just a couple points. Well, you heard them. The bottom left corner, the blue, is water supply, $1 billion a year. On the right corner, the green, flood control, $500 million a year to keep the pipes open to throw away $500 million worth of water. Up on top, sanitation. When you look at the city as a forest, sanitation is the third largest budget in the city of LA after police and fire. Third largest after police and fire. 40% of our waste stream is mulch. It's a watershed tool. It's a soil protector. We need it there, not in the landfills. Anyhow, our vision was to bring people together and plant flowers. Now, it gets beautiful when you can get people to work together. And I need to fly through this. So here's the house during the rainstorm. There are some of the cisterns, water being rechanneled from our bent downspouts. One example of another demonstration project. We created that curriculum that you heard about. The kids went out on their campus. They measured. They investigated. They did math. They spoke. They dreamed. The city heard. Our Department of Water and Power added $250,000 to their campus so we could do this. Imagine the power you feel when you're a little elementary school kid and you see that your vision resulted in infrastructure bigger than, those are little humans up above that. That is a stormwater filtering machine connected to these drain pipes that takes the flood water from their flooding campus and puts it back underground. This was their schoolyard before. This is the place where on 600 campuses across Los Angeles, we fry our kids every day. And I'm not kidding. Skin cancer is now the largest, fastest cancer rate in this country, and 13-year-olds are the most at-risk population. This is the campus today. But what's important about this is that this is now the city's water supply, flood control system, and stormwater cleanup system. It is not just simple light greening of lawn and trees that are consuming water. This is healing, and it's bringing the resources to keep this school now as a park, protecting these kids. Let's keep going. We went to Sun Valley. Every time it rains, the community floods. As I said, we began construction first with this project. We're putting another massive infiltrator in under a park. It's big. And above this will be a lovely soccer field lighted for the kids. I have 3 minutes left. I want to get right to the video. Lovely images here. But if we can cue the video, I want you to see how it's still scaling up. Go for it, folks. Oh, it should be ABC.
Nice weekend. Yeah,
well, you know, despite the record rainfall, experts say Los Angeles is still facing drought conditions. But local environmentalists say there are ways to help solve the city's long-term water shortage. Bill Smith has the details.
Not that we haven't seen enough real rain, but here is a little simulated rain from the group Tree People, demonstrating how to save the runoff from the storms and turn it into rich, green, healthy grass. In this case, for the students at Open Charter Elementary near LAX.
The rain, it goes into the storm drain, and then that goes into the cistern, and it separates it from the trash and all the dirty water. So then the water will be clean, and we can use it for sprinklers and, yeah.
Does it work?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. The water is stored in a cistern-type reservoir underground, right here beneath the playground grass.
We need this water so badly, and LA is searching for long-term solutions.
And this just might be one of those solutions, an idea to capture rain from the storms and then put it to use later when you need it.
That during the rainfall, we would collect the water and we use it for the summer months.
Okay, kids, now show me one more time. All that water from all those storms goes down the drain and into that reservoir underneath your playground because...
It's so that we could save water by reusing all the rainwater.
Instead of letting it get away into, where's it get away to?
The ocean.
We don't want that?
No.
And if you think this is all about saving just a little extra water, well, tree people say this last batch of storms through Southern California brought some 80 billion gallons of water that just slipped right through our fingers, right back out into the ocean. Bill Smith, KTLA News.
It does get better. The city learned from that process and began working to integrate its wastewater system with its water supply system, with its stormwater system, the first ever integrated system. It's been a four-year planning process with multiple 125 stakeholders, environmentalists, taxpayer groups, people who are usually at loggerheads in a well-facilitated deep learning environment. The plan, called the IRP, the Integrated Resources Plan, plans for distributed water treatment systems like that, greening schools, greening communities all over the city. They found when they started they had planned to add one whole new sewage treatment plant for $4 billion. They will now not have to build that and liberate the $4 billion for greening the city and helping communities. But as I say, it's not off life support. The agencies need a lot more help to stay at the table and stay integrated, and that's where your job comes in. You really need to demand this from your cities wherever you live. It's not acceptable to be working in the disintegrated environment. We don't all have the skill to do integration, but the technology is there. It's calling forth from all of us going deeper in our technology skills, our communication skills, keeping people's feet to the fire, and asking and demanding the best. Other cities are beginning to copy this and to work with us. City of Seattle brought us up to look at a plan for Salmon Safe Seattle to put the forest ecosystem back into their lovely city. And they have rushed ahead and are building some great, great stuff. So let me just conclude with back to you. Are you prepared? Are you ready? As things start to shake, we saw during the disasters that people who used the old paradigm adage of take care of number one in trying to take care of themselves when the storms hit and the floods hit, they got emotionally shocked, emotionally disabled, and became useless. When they said, I'm going to be strong and I'm going to take care of my neighbors, they took on a mantle of protection and strength, no matter who they were. And they didn't get hurt. They may have lost their house, but they stayed able. They stayed able to rescue themselves and their friends, their families, their neighbors. We're moving into those times, and you need that strength. And in case you are thinking, but I don't have it, he's not talking to me, because I'm just this vulnerable person. You know, I get great strength from looking at the other leaders and speakers up here, and often I think, I can't speak like that. I'm not that smart. I'm not that strong. I'm just little. And I think about the redwood trees. They're huge. They're some of the largest living beings on the planet. They inspire us. But how could we ever get there? You know, the redwood seed is one of the smallest seeds, almost microscopic, in the world. When it first sprouts, you can't see it, but it grows to be something that inspires us, protects us. We are all the same. In that vulnerability, what gives us strength is getting bumped around a little bit, trying things, failing, using that failure as compost for success. Go for it. Thank you. We're in it together as we re-knit our lives and our communities. Thank you so much.
Tax and beer duty to help hardworking people do more of the things they enjoy. The chancellor said the cut was prompted by the fact that the number of bingo halls had plummeted by 3/4 over the last 30 years. Maybe it has something to do with, like, modern media, the internet, games, things to do that are better than playing bingo.
Yeah, it's curious that he would be so fascinated with bingo that the number of bingo halls is diminishing, so he's going to cut the profits on the bingo profits to resuscitate the bingo business. This would seem like a misplaced use of taxpayer money somehow.
Well, actually, the biggest bingo operator said they're going to open 3 new bingo halls.
Well, this is just failing to resuscitate what is an economy moribund with excessive debt due to speculation and misplaced bets along the way. So, therefore, bingo itself would seem to be the last place one would want to put that money.
It makes me think that they haven't encountered a working class person since maybe the 1950s. But it's also important in bingo lingo to, when you shout out the numbers, to get the numbers right, because you don't want to call out the wrong number and then the wrong person thinks they won. So I wanted to look at the importance of numbers. Over in the United States this week, there was also another important announcement. Here in the UK, you had the budget 2014. In the United States, you had Janet Yellen's first ever press conference. Stocks tumble after Yellen says 6 months. During the Q&A of a press conference Wednesday afternoon, Janet Yellen said the Fed could start raising interest rates as soon as 6 months after it was done winding down its stimulative quantitative easing program. This was a much narrower time frame than expected.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about this bingo thing. You know, I think I got it now. The Tories, the toffs in power, basically, their perception of the working class here in Britain are people buying beers and playing bingo. That's their perception of the working class. So to appease these folks, they're getting them a pee off on the beer and give them on an industry that's in decline, bingo. But this is their perception. This is what they oh, lovey, oh, darling, the working class must get a little bingo boost. They have no actual connection to what people might be doing on the working side of the equation that would support the economy that they are so egregiously ripping off day to day on these hard-earned folks. But moving forward to Janet Yellen, yes, she has indicated that the potential for raising interest rates would be, you know, 6 months after they end quantitative easing. So she's putting a date on when the free money, the bingo profits, are being cut to the speculators on Wall Street in the City of London. And, of course, stocks move down on that news. But this is the pas de deux that we see going on between reality and fantasy, is that every time they talk about raising interest rates, of course, markets will drop, and then they will keep rates low. So for the foreseeable future, as long as it's possible to crash markets, then rates will be cheap to make it easier to crash markets.
Yes, I mean, regarding the bingo, even the Bingo Association said it's going to have no money in the pocket effect for the actual bingo players. So there won't actually be what was like, it's a 40 million pound industry. Who knows? It's like not, it's like pocket change, right? It's not a very huge industry.
No.
Here in terms of the American bingo, you know, actually their taxes are about the same as what the bingo was, is 20% in capital gains. But she should have used this term instead of 6 months. She should have said chopsticks, which is the bingo lingo, when somebody said that would have been more amusing, but also it would have confused, because remember, everybody likes Fed speak, which is very similar to bingo lingo. It's like Alan Greenspan is the one that mastered this, where he would just speak total nonsense and the markets would be very happy with that. They would say calm.
Yeah, I think that Janet Yellen should be running a bingo shop in Britain somewhere, maybe in Blackpool. There would be Janet Yellen with like a turban on, talking about in this bingo lingo kind of way, indicating to the people on the bankers and the speculators and the fraudsters out there in the audience, trying to line up their collateralized debt obligation with free money from the Fed, with graft from Goldman Sachs, with market manipulators, J.P. Morgan. Bingo! Bingo!
So basically, they got rid of forward guidance. They did it here as well. And forward quantitative guidance. They've now adopted a new term of qualitative guidance. So the headline means stocks take dive after Fed moves. So investors were trying to come to grips with this new phrase of qualitative guidance, what was it means. And the Fed did away with its prior guidance, which was quantitative threshold based on the nation's jobless rate. The Fed had been using a 6.5% unemployment rate as its threshold to start the process, or at least kick off the debate about raising rates. However, with the jobless rate at 6.7% and the rate itself viewed as a flawed measure of the actual health of the job market, the Fed opted to phase out the numerical threshold. So it's called qualitative guidance.
Well, the markets are addicted to cheap money. And, you know, the Fed, under tail end of Greenspan, enter Bernanke, they would lower interest rates in response to various crises, and they have not yet moved to raise those rates to restore balance to these markets, to restore the risk and reward balance. Because right now, if you are on the right side of the apartheid wall, the interest rate apartheid wall, you can make unlimited amounts of money with no risk. If you're on the other side of the interest rate apartheid wall, then you absorb all the risk and your ability to make any kind of substantial money is curtailed and you are living in the interest rate engineered ghetto. So the language from Janet Yellen is a language of the obfuscator. Yes, the Federal Reserve Chairman always uses very obfuscating language to hide. They don't want to telegraph to the market what they're doing because they don't want to give traders an unfair advantage. However, under forward guidance, they did telegraph to the market saying, yeah, we're going to make money as cheap as possible so you can speculate all day and take all the money out of the economy you want. We don't care because we don't need the workers. We just print the money. We don't need the taxes. So now they're changing the language somewhat, but at the end of the day, what it means is that Janet Yellen will retire as a bingo mistress, probably a dominatrix, somewhere at a Soho bingo parlor, and that's the way she'll end her days.
But it also shows as well that why you adopt this bingo lingo, instead of saying six, you say chopping sticks, because, you know, six is a real number, and people can, you know, grab onto it and prove you're wrong. Or, you know, you say tickety-boo or clickety-click. And these are, like, more comforting to the markets. Now, how they're adopting this qualitative number, for example. So they're no longer looking at the actual real unemployment number because, of course, those are fake anyway. Those might as well be bingo lingo. So they said a wide range of information will now be included, such as measures of labor market conditions, indicators of inflation pressures, and inflation expectations and readings on financial developments, i.e. clickety-click, tickety-boo. It makes no sense.
Well, it's like George Osborne's budget speech. They don't mention the fact that the debt is going to be higher this year than ever before, and it'll continue to go higher. Inclusive of all bank debt, the UK has never been more indebted. So, yeah, they can play around with semantics. They can point to different areas of the economy. They can give people a bingo tax break. But the fact is that the indebtedness of the country is ever increasing because they're doing nothing to get rid of the worst actors that are these zombie banks that are sucking all this money from the Bank of England and from these other countries and from these other institutions. And the austerity that's being imposed is only there to inflict cruelty. There's no economic basis for it.
In fact, if you want to look at this next headline and chart that comes with it, this is, I think, why ultimately they will never be able to raise rates again. The most important economic chart, and this is productivity per output per hour. That's the blue line. And the red line is median family real income. The chart shows that productivity or output per hour of work has quadrupled since 1947 in the United States. The gains in productivity were quite widely shared from 1947 to 1980 when, as you could see from the chart, the red line there, the income from the median family declined, declined, declined while productivity rose. Of course, Max, in 1980, what you think of is at the peak of gold and Paul Volcker basically coming in with interest rates and basically convincing the world to go off a gold standard and that the dollar is king and it's good as gold. And however, from that point, you see that the average worker's income declined.
Right, so productivity gains were shared in that purchasing power was maintained so that you would work more and you could buy more stuff with a dollar that was tied to something tangible. Now, starting in 1971, actually, and then moving forward into the 80s when the purchasing power started to collapse, but the equation of hours worked for pay didn't change, then you could say, well, productivity is robust or not robust, but the fact is you could not afford to buy the same amount of stuff as you could at the end of the week or the end of the month as you could before. Meanwhile, the asset prices that are owned by those who are engineering this divorce from gold into fiat, the assets they own, like the fine art and chateaus in France and London real estate, continue to go up in value exponentially. So, like, once again, you create this apartheid, economic apartheid, using productivity in a salacious manner that makes no sense with an underlying economic understanding of how the business climate works. You misquote GDP, you cook CPI, and you present, as Osborne does, or as somebody in the United States does, a completely false picture of the economy to benefit the few at the expense of the rest. It's been going on for 20 years. It's getting worse, though.
But it's also that dichotomy, the difference between, say, bingo lingo and Fed speak. So bankers and the financial sort of experts know the real number. They know, like, stop farting is 83.
What? Stop farting is 83. That's bingo lingo?
You're supposed to call back who, me?
Who? What? Jeez, I got to get down to the bingo parlor because I'm missing out on some very interesting things.
But, you know, the productivity number was going up while, you know, the average worker is being distracted by the Fed speak the bingo lingo, and they don't realize that their income was going down because they're distracted by different numbers that the likes of Janet Yellen are saying, like, we're going to use qualitative right. instead of quantitative.
This productivity number increase is there are people working more hours for the same. Essentially. So they're saying, well, productivity is going up. You know, the most productive work environment of all is prison. People are essentially working there all day for 20 cents a day. The most productive citizens in the UK and America are the prison population. Oh, and by the way, who has the biggest prison population in the world? The U.S. Who's building private prisons now at a furious pace or will about to? The UK. Because the prison business is a profitable business. Everyone in the prison is the most productive members of society. They work all day for 20 cents. Look at the productivity we're getting out of these prisoners. We're fantastic financial engineers.
Bingo!
Who, me? All right, Stacey, we gotta go. Thanks.
I'm going to Butlins.
Excellent. All right, stay tuned for the second half. A whole lot more. Welcome back to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Egon von Greyerz, Managing Director of Matterhorn Asset Management in Zurich. Egon, welcome to the Kaiser Report.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right, Egon, we've just had some pronouncements from Janet Yellen and the Fed. There's always an interesting connection between what she says and the price of gold, which, of course, is your specialty. Maybe just open us up a little bit by talking a little bit on this.
Yes, well, you know, Janet Yellen is not going to change anything from what Bernanke did. I mean, they are the biggest money creators in the world, the Fed, and they will continue to do so. Okay, short term, so she had to continue with tapering, but that won't last. And actually, you know, the influence of the Fed announcement on gold, the last six times I've gone back and seen gold goes down every time and often quite substantially around the Fed announcement. And then in the last few months, it's gone up, back up every time again. So it's a good trade going short before the Fed announcement and then buying back again.
Okay, you just said something there. You said that tapering won't last. Now, just to remind people what tapering is, I mean, the quantitative easing was this idea of the Fed buying back all these bonds, effectively monetizing the debt. Now this has gone on for a while. People are asking, when are they going to get out of this quantitative easing? And the word used is taper. They're buying less on a monthly basis. But they're saying that they're possibly going to stop quantitative easing. And she said within 6 months after that, interest rates would go higher. You're saying no tapering, absolutely not. Talk a little bit about this.
Well, the Fed lives in a dream world. You know, they believe that, like the president, that the U.S. economy is booming and that things are going to get only better. It won't happen. The U.S. economy is bankrupt. It will continue to be bankrupt. They need to issue unlimited amounts of money to survive. And that's, of course, printing money will never create wealth, so they won't survive with that either. But they will just kick the can down the road. So the Fed will continue to print money. That might be tapering for another couple of months, but thereafter there will be events that will necessitate the Fed printing money at an accelerated rate, in my view.
How would you compare, let's say, what's going on in the Fed, the United States, and the Bank of England here in the UK? Obviously, they have a new chairman, Mark Carney. They've come out with their recent budget discussions. It appears that with programs like the Help to Buy scheme, which is a way to underwrite the real estate market, like the Fannie Mae in America, it's very similar to the U.S.
Very similar. You know, there are two areas of the UK economy that are booming. One is behind us here, the city. Everyone is rich in the city because if you have money, you can make money because everybody, every central bank in the world helps you to print money and therefore to trade with money and to make very nice returns on the money. The other market, which is prospering, is the housing market. You cannot have an economy based on finance and on people buying houses, especially now with no money down and subsidized interest rates. So the UK consumer is borrowing, the US housing market is booming. That won't last either.
Okay, Egon, basically, if correct me if I'm wrong, but over there at Matterhorn Asset Management in Switzerland, the firm that you run, that you're the chairman of, the goal is wealth preservation, and the medium for this is gold. So gold not necessarily for trade, gold not as an investment, but gold as wealth preservation. What does that mean? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, we decided already 12 years ago in 2002 that the world was going to be in a mess and that it was absolutely essential to preserve wealth. So we told our clients that we even set up to 50% of their their financial assets into the physical gold.
Okay, so that's a very, let's say, aggressive recommendation, because typically people would say put 5% into gold. But your firm, back when gold was $253 an ounce, you said up to 50% in gold.
Yeah. So obviously everybody didn't put 50% in. We have clients who have 100% in gold almost, and we have clients who have 5 or 10. So, but nevertheless, we saw that the destruction of paper money was going to accelerate. So it was, for us, you buy something when it's unloved and undervalued. And at that time, gold was both unloved and undervalued. So it was pretty easy. Now, governments will, as they have done throughout history, continue to destroy the value of paper money by printing unlimited amounts of it. And so they have been doing, they're still doing it. You know, Bernanke, during his period as chairman of the Fed, the debt of the United States of America went from $8 trillion to $17 trillion. So he created more debt in his 7 years than it took the U.S. to create for over 200 years. They went from zero to $8 trillion over 200 years, and he created $8 trillion in just over 7 years. Yeah, that will continue. Yeah, that will continue. Also, they can't do anything else. They're running budget deficits. They've run budget deficits for over 50 years. They're running trade deficits for the same period.
Right, and it seems like everything is tied to this idea of interest rates being near zero in perpetuity, which is kind of a crazy bet. But before I talk about interest rates, I wanted to throw something out at you and see what your response is. Basically, people talk about the price of gold, and they fixate on, it's $1,900, it's $1,500, it's $1,300, and they really focus on price. I want to introduce this concept, price versus availability. The idea here is that when the time comes when you really need your gold because of the banking system collapse from all this shenanigans, there might not be gold available for you at any price. If you know what I'm getting at. In other words, there's issues in Switzerland and around the world where people are going to collect their gold from the bank. Yeah. And your service, by the way, is not a bank. It's a vault. Big difference. And it's not there. So here's my topic. Price versus availability. Take it away.
Yeah. Well, you know that the paper market in gold is about 100 times the physical market. We live in a paper world today. Everybody believes in paper. But sadly, the paper gold holders will not get any gold. And when the problem starts in the economy, and they will do, and people start worrying about the fact that the bullion banks have no gold, the central banks don't have anywhere near the gold they say they have, and people start then saying, I want delivery, they won't get gold. They'll get money, maybe, if they're lucky. And COMEX will not be able to deliver either the futures market we're talking about.
Brian Banks, HSBC, JP Morgan.
Correct.
And others. You're saying they don't have the gold they say they have.
Exactly. They don't have the gold, and the central banks certainly don't have the gold. They said they're supposed to have 30,000 tons. I don't think they have half, even less. I mean, everybody in the gold market knows that the Fed has not had an audit since Eisenhower's days of their gold.
And it's in Asia.
It's in Asia because what happened, especially when gold fell last year, which is, I'm sure you've been through this before, when gold fell last year, this has manipulated the fall of the gold price so that the bullion banks could fill up their vaults. What happened instead is that, because normally everything, the bullion banks, when they buy and sell, the gold stays with them. The buyer and the seller is always with them, central banks, you know, the ETFs, etc. As it happened now, the Chinese bought all the gold that actually became available.
And so, Russia?
And Russia also.
Let me ask you this quick on a geopolitical front. It seems like on a geopolitical equation, you've got now Russia, China are kind of siding up against, and we'll call them the oil and gold and gas powers versus the paper powers of the U.S., the U.K., on that other side. So it's gold versus paper in this currency war, as you could call it. Over the last few years, during the price fall, China and Russia have been aggressively buying gold.
Yeah.
Are they now in a position where they can reject the U.S. dollar as global reserve currency and strike out on their own? And is that part of what we're seeing in these global tensions?
Absolutely, in my view. I mean, the dollar does not deserve to be the reserve currency of the world, sadly. You know, coming from Switzerland, when I started working in Switzerland a long time ago, 1970 roughly, the Swiss franc to the dollar, it was $1 for Swiss francs 30. Today, it's about 88 cents. That's a fall of 80%. And only in the last 12 years, the dollar has gone down 50% against the Swiss franc. The dollar is on the road to perdition. Sadly, but it's, you know, you cannot run all these deficits that I just mentioned and consistently overspend and spend what you don't have and print money and at the same time be the reserve currency of the world. So, yes, the dollar is on its way now. I mean, they're trying to support it at various points, but the dollar is on its way now to crash. All currencies, of course, are going down to their intrinsic value, zero, but the dollar will be the first one. So I believe it's only a matter of time before, as you say, China, Russia, etc. First, I mean, the wonderful weapon that Russia has now is just to stop using dollars altogether in the Ukraine and Crimea battle here. And, of course, that will hurt the U.S. more than anything else. You know, never mind all the sanctions they're trying to...
We've heard about currency wars.
Yeah.
So you're saying that in the currency war, let's call it a big poker game. Russia, China are holding three aces in their gold, and then the U.S. has got a pair of twos.
Absolutely. Especially because they have a very weak currency that is overvalued because the whole world is trading in it. But once they stop trading in it, I think China and Russia will be the first countries to stop trading in it.
They're doing a lot of bilateral deals now.
Yeah, already.
Brazil, other BRIC nations, a lot of bilateral deals. I want to talk about this idea of manipulation for a second because it's a contentious topic. But one area that we know, without a doubt, we see the manipulation happening, and that is when we see it almost every single day. The price of gold in Asia is up overnight because people in Asia are buying gold. You know, they realize this paper money empire is about to collapse. Yeah. And then when the price hits New York, it's COMEX, you see a big dump almost every single day. To me, that's a clear sign of manipulation. It's not price discovery, it's price manipulation.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
No, there's constant price manipulation, and especially you can see it happening because it's always in a thin market, and you know the trades are always crazy. No one would dump the amount of gold, or in this case, paper gold, of course, is never physical, that they dump when they manipulate because they just, you know, you'd lose a fortune every time you do it. So the manipulation, there are many people, Chris Powell of Gartner and others who are, you know, more experts in this than I am, but it's absolutely clear there's manipulation. organization. Because why do they do it? Well, because first of all, because they haven't got the goal that they have, so they actually, you know, need to get the price down. And secondly, gold reveals the bad management of the economy, and that's why they want gold down. So, but I have a very firm view that manipulation only lasts short term. You know, in the long run, the real market will win, and in this case, gold will win. They cannot, you know, they haven't, in the last 14 years, we've gone from 250 to 1,330 today. That trend will continue, because all it does is to reflect the destruction of paper money.
All right, fair enough. Egon Van Grives, thanks so much for being on the Kaiser Report.
Okay, it's a pleasure to be here, Max. Thanks very much.
And that's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our guest, Egon Van Grierts of Matterhorn Asset Management. If you'd like to get in touch, tweet us at Kaiser Report. Until next time, bye, y'all.
You heard it from the man. The gold is not there. Saint Germain has the gold. When he decides to give it, he decides.
The decider.
That's it.
I am the decider.
Oh, my goodness, everybody. Oh, my goodness. Oh, well. I wanted to read a little piece here. This is from our Virgo, cosmic story Virgo full moon that we had last Sunday here. Tomorrow's Sunday again, but I just thought there's a little poem at the top here that's just lovely, and I'll just read a little bit. The Virgin, the purity of heart, the application to detail. Okay. What as our religion was each other, as our practice was our life, as prayer our words, what as the temple was the earth, as forests were our church, as holy water the rivers, lakes, and oceans. What as meditation was our relationships, as the teacher was life, as wisdom was self-knowledge, as love was the center of our being. That was written by Ganga White. So at the time, the waters of Pisces were still swimming around in that last Sunday. And so flip over on your back, they said, and let the moonlight bathe and soothe your body and soul. That's when spirit's voice comes clear. Perhaps you've been lost in the dark watery depths amidst strangely glowing night creatures or swimming fast and free with a pod of dolphins or breaching with a family of whales. Perhaps you've gotten stuck in stagnant seas of weeds and grass or finally been tumbled to distant shores. As you've flowed with Pisces watery energies, you might feel as your life is dissolving into a new unity of spirit. As you've struggled against the tides, you might find yourself lost at sea. Yet wherever you find yourself on full moon night, take the magical moonlight into your heart. Listen to and look at what's there. The Virgo full moon tells us you belong to yourself. As much as you are a part of the whole, you are also a unique drop in the ocean of consciousness. What do you want to do with your drop? What does your drop want to do with you? We are all here on Earth for the specific reasons that are encoded within our soul, as our physical body is encoded by our DNA. Each of us has a destiny. Each destiny is unique and yet part of the whole. Are we rebirthing the archetype of the Divine Mother? Because our society needs nurturing, love, and comfort. Are we transforming the archetypal image of Father into the wise guide, the caring protector, the truthful judge? Our world needs more of these people. Do you find yourself incarnating the archetypical energy? The archetypal energy of warrior, of healer, of artist, of bard, of the leader, the priestess, or the priest? How about the conscious merchant, the courageous scout? Uranus in Aries opens us to these archetypal identities as we are challenged to recreate the society that Pluto in Capricorn tears down. As we are truly one universe, then our instructions are clear. Be your unique self. What do you want to be? Virgo is the sign of the Virgin, the one who knows, seeks self-knowledge. To know oneself, both light and shadow. Our Christian era has redefined virgin to only mean its physical sexual aspect. In ancient times, a virgin was a woman who belonged to no man, who was a woman in her own right. She belonged to herself. Each of us, man and woman, can reclaim our feminine virginal energy. We can belong to ourselves. On this virgin Virgo full moon night, we can see who we are meant to be as we are willing to acknowledge who we really are. Remember, this was last Sunday. Virgo's shadow distorts our need to know ourselves into the need to control things. To attain the ideal of perfection, someone else's idea of perfection. Virgo's real purpose is to help us know and accept who we really are. Virgo's analytical mind measures and aligns. Virgo's magic understands, overstands how everything fits together to make it work. Virgo's greatest gift is discernment, knowing this from that. This helps us master a talent and understand how it can be of service to others. On full moon night, the Piscean Ocean will send out a drop of its womb-like waters to each of us, filtered through the Virgo moon, the drop of our Piscean longing and dreams. Who do you see? Do you see yourself? Virgo full moon occurs and did last Sunday, March 16th, 10:08 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. The Virgo full moon gets support from Saturn retrograde in Scorpio, just as the full moon acceptance of self gives support to Saturn's deep emotional restructuring. Saturn in Scorpio has been hard on us because looking at our darker feelings is hard. Saturn in Scorpio puts the squeeze on us through our unresolved fears, wounds, betrayals, obsessions. Scorpio is the sign of death and rebirth. A death and rebirth of our emotional body, our feeling nature, our heart is where we get our passion and love of life. It is also the place where our complexes and behaviors are molded. Scorpio is the container of all our emotional wounds, an alchemical container of transformation. Saturn is the taskmaster. Saturn's truth is that we learn more from pain than from pleasure. Saturn teaches us to survive because Saturn is the energy that grounds us here. Saturn in Scorpio can give us the discipline, the focus, to treat one another as we'd like to be treated. Self-respect is key to accepting ourselves, both the light and the dark. Self-respect gives us the courage to look in the dark and discover the treasures hidden behind the pain that keeps us in the dark. Now that Saturn is retrograde, you're just backing up the truck a week. These things are still something that we did, and so it has built upon something, so we can keep this record in our consciousness of how we got here now. So now that Saturn is retrograde, we got to look into Scorpio's realm. We get to look inside ourselves to understand our fears, bind our wounds with meaning, forgive our betrayers, and let go of our obsessions. We get to restructure our emotional complexes and our behaviors as it becomes us to relating with others. So let go of our fears and insecurities. Take a new emotional stand. Act as though it's really you until you feel it. And it becomes a new way of being for each and every one. Understanding and accepting ourselves is the first step. The lunar nodes have changed signs, moving from Scorpio backwards into a Libra. The moon's nodes point in space, where the planes of the sun, moon, and earth line up, along with another plane that took a little off into the dimensions here. The points in space where eclipses occur. They move counterclockwise in the sky from 30 degrees to zero of a sign. They focus our collective attention on what needs to be released, what needs to be learned. For the past year and a half, we have learned to release old values. Taurus, that make us complacent and learn more about how to work with others and their values to achieve results. We certainly still have that opportunity here. We've got these great superpowers now. Russia's making different arrangements with China, the United States, and behind the scenes, those three presidents of those three countries have been working together, whether it looks like it or not at the moment. Now, our lessons involve the balance between ourselves and others, between Aries and Libra. Aries' south nodes indicate lessons around selfishness, arrogance, frustration, the need for self-sacrifice to accommodate the needs of others. The Libra north node demands we learn the lessons of cooperation, balance, of healthy respect for self and others, of the need to balance masculine and feminine energies to create a new whole. With a true sense of ourselves, we can step into new emotional behavior patterns with others, where we see each other's truths and acknowledge our own. With Mars retrograding in Libra till May 19th through the 20th, and not leaving Libra until the end of July, it is indeed the time to practice our people skills. Courtesy, respect are always in order with Libra's love of grace and charm. Venus and Mars are still ruling the nodal positions, with Libra's Venus calling us to harmony, calling us to peace, over Mars and Aries' shouts for war. since Mars is staying in Venus' house for a while, I am sure she can convince him to change his ways. The destined push toward Libra from the nodal axis will help her. Not that Aphrodite is full splendor. In full splendor needs much help as we honor her. Neptune and Chiron in Pisces are pulled into the energy of the Pluto-Uranus square through Jupiter in Cancer. With these planets in Pisces, one of the things I feel going on in the collective unconscious is that our imaginations are being healed. And perhaps we are relating to them in a different way. Perhaps our media, owned by only 5 companies now, overcomes and impresses our imaginations with their symbols and images, shaping our beliefs to their specifications. Yet as we engage the imagination through inner journey, through active imagination, through creative visualization, we work with the imagination to learn something new about ourselves and the world. We open ourselves to possibilities and bring those back into our outer reality through our creativity and innovation, our love and caring. Jupiter is in Cancer, opening our hearts to the possibilities waiting to be birthed. Tied into the Piscean energies, Jupiter channels and engenders spirit within us. Listen within to your heart's desire. Perhaps as you get up while it's still dark out, you'll see Venus in Aquarius shining brightly as the morning star. At the full moon, Venus inspires Uranus to activate her highest ideals as we imagine who we are meant to be. Venus's relationship with Jupiter can give us a broad, generous, and gracious outlook as considering the needs of ourselves and others. Since Aphrodite, Venus, was born out of the Piscean collective unconscious, it is only right that we embrace her gifts of love, beauty, and wisdom as we work to give shape to our destiny together. The cosmic story is heating up, preparing for a week of intense energies in April. We just got through this week, coming into Sunday now. I'll write more about that in the Aries New Moon newsletter. Okay, everybody. And we'll get that one next. But wow, that was okay. There's a little poem. Let me just do it. It's called Sometimes. Sometimes, as you move carefully through the forest, breathing like the ones in the old stories, who could cross a shimmering bed of dry leaves without a sound? You come to a place whose only task is to trouble you with tiny yet frightening requests, conceived out of nowhere, yet in this place beginning to lead everywhere. Requests to stop what you are doing right now, and to stop what you are becoming while you do it. Questions that can make or unmake a life. Questions that have patiently waited for you. Questions that have no right to go away. By David White. Everything is waiting for all of us, wishing us peace, love, and wisdom. This is from Kathy Pagano. Pagano. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece. You can find this at there's hyphens between the title, but it's www.wisdomofastrology.com. Like a hyphen between wisdom and of and astrology.com. Wonderful, 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 wonderful. Okay. Now we got to go on our adventure here. A chapter of adventure called The City of David, Zion on the North, chapter 39, from when rocks cry out.
This is...
Hmm?
Huh. I was just thinking about Zion in the movie Matrix. Yeah.
There are several ancient accounts that mention David's fortress or citadel, which stood above and on the north side of the main city called Jerusalem and Thebes. First, the passage from Josephus Histories. Quote, let me move this over here just a minute. That's good. Quote, as David had cast the Jebusites out of the citadel, he also rebuilt Jerusalem and named it the City of David, and abode where all the time of his reign, there all the time of his reign. Then the biblical passages are pressed into place. Quote, and the king and his men went to Jerusalem unto the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. David took the stronghold of Zion. The name is the city of David. So, David dwelt in the fort and called it the city of David. That's the second book of Samuel, chapters 5 through 9. Quote, beautiful for situation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion on the north, on the sides of the north, the city of the great king. From Psalms chapter 48, verse 2. These biblical descriptions clearly locate the fortress called Zion, the city of David, on the north side of the lower city of Jerusalem. Curiously, archaeologists and modern scholars ignored these Old Testament descriptions until the first edition of this book was published. After that publication, efforts began in the Middle East to find David's city on the north side of that Jerusalem. Scholars knew ancient histories placed the city of David on a raised spur of rock. Yet because there is no such spur against the northern side of the place now being called Jerusalem, scholars had pointed to a hill south of that city and labeled it the city of David. In Peru, Heru, Peru, right? The raised mount that once shouldered the city of David has a name and a history. Peruvian traditions give the name Sacsahuaman, 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 to that mount that was once called Zion. As you pronounce Sacsahuaman, as some tour guides instruct you, sexy women, you may never comprehend that it is the Egyptian deity Amen, whose name was given to this sacred hill. Native Peruvian history about Sacsahuaman includes the important tradition that this hill was both fortress and temple. The Peruvian tradition that this mountain fortress served as the burial place for kings is confirmed by biblical passages that speak of burials at this city. Quote, so David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. The first of Kings, chapter 2, verse 10. Jehoiada, J-E-H-O-I-A-D-A, waxed old and was full of days, as he died. And 130 years old was he as he died. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings. From 2 Corinthians chapter 24, verses 15 and 16. Azariah, the king of Judah, his servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem and buried him in his sepulcher with his father in the city of David, 2 Kings chapter 9, verse 28. Another biblical passage places a pool near David's sepulcher in the fortress. After him repaired, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, onto the place over against the sepulchers of David and to the pool that was made and onto the house of the mighty. This is from N-E-H, I'm not sure, N-E-H, chapter 3, verse 16. I got to go look that up. Among the ruins of Sacsahuaman are those pools mentioned in the Old Testament. There is something else that shows Cuzco and its northern fortress to be the Jerusalem of King David that archaeologists say is missing in the Middle East. Cuzco has a canal that runs straight and on the west side of the mountain fortress that was Zion. The Old Testament mentions that canal. Quote, this same Hezekiah also stopped the upper water course of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. 2 Corinthians chapter 32, verse 30. Another biblical passage clarifies that this water course was a canal or conduit, and the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might and how he made a pool and a conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? From the 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20. Back on the other side of the world from Peru, scholars point to a twisting underground tunnel at the modern Jerusalem and call that tunnel the Hezekiah Canal. That tunnel fails to match the clear biblical descriptions of it. That canal is not straight, and it does not run to the west side of the city of David. The canal at Cuzco is the canal described in the biblical writings about Hezekiah. For any skeptic who prefers to doubt the biblical placement of Zion on the northern side of Jerusalem, there is the extraordinary clarification provided by an account from the mid-13th century. It was written by the Jewish traveler, Rabbi Jacob, the messenger of Rabbi Jekiel of Paris. He wrote, quote, "Today, Jerusalem lies to the northwest of the Temple Mount, not as it used to be on the south of the Temple Mount, as it is said in Ezekiel chapter 40, verse 2. Quote, "The frame of the city on the south," unquote. And in Psalms chapter 48, verse 3, "Mount Zion on the sides of the north." It is this ancient city in Peru, and not the latter city in the Middle East, that fits the biblical and other ancient descriptions of Jerusalem. To cement that truth as fact, I now reveal what the ancient writers called the Millo, M-I-L-L-O. Okay, I pass this long-stemmed, lavender, Excalibur, emerald, serpent-feathered, Quetzalcoatl talking stick to my sister, Rain Bird. Here and now. Wow. Okay, now listen, you're kind of very, very, very muffled, Lady Master. We okay. need some clearer sound. Much more clear.
How about this?
That's better, sister. That's good. We like to hear your beautiful soul coming from your words of beauty.
Okay. So thank you for another amazing day on the phone.
Rainbird, can you do a little better than that? It's still kind of, you sound like you're in a tunnel.
Okay.
There we go. That's better.
Okay. So today is this day when the 13 grandmothers gathered, I think it was in Arizona, and did their good work for this planet and are dreaming the dream awake and loving the mother back to health and blessing all the waters and the nature spirits and all the human two-legged and the four-legged on this turtle island and put their prayers there and brought it together in that way. And so much gratitude to these 13 grandmothers for their gathering and their good work today. And much gratitude for all of our goodly company who do their work and help us get through this eye of the needle. And we're so grateful for all of our ancestors standing by us as we make this change in this age, in this shift, with this bringing in that festival of flowers of the new age. And so we have much gratitude for those ancestors for holding that space for us on the Blue Road as we do our work here on the Good Red Road. And we have much gratitude for all of the Sky Nation. Mm-hmm. And how they support us and what we do here, and may our lives be a blessing to them as well. And all of our gratitude to the mother who holds us on her back, lets us ride on her breast. Thank you, Mother Earth, for your life, for your healing and your cleansing. May we be of service. Always. And also much gratitude for all of us. Much gratitude for all of our lives. And thank you for being in our lives. And thank you for showing up here each week. And thank you for the working that you do. And thank you for the blessings that you send our way so that we can continue doing this good work. We're grateful to gather, and we're grateful for the work that we do. So 13 thank yous and honey in the heart. All my relations. And the whole Matakriyasin. So namaste. And stop nam. I pass that talking stick back to you, Rama. I'm looking forward to some good music or poetry. Thank you for your good work.
Oh, boy. Okay, we're going to let these Canadian Toronto brothers honor the feminine with their gorgeous voices again tonight. So we're going to pass this little microphone over for Rama to set it up over there. Let's just...
It's been such a joy to be able to travel the world and to share our voices, and we've had so many amazing experiences. And, you know, the flip side is being away from loved ones and from family. We're here tonight, and I think a sentiment like bring him home really, you know, reminds us of how, you know, important our family is. So thank you, Fraser, for making us very, very sad.
We are also very excited to introduce a very special guest. She is a Grammy nominee. She's a Gospel Music Award winner, Best Female Artist of the Year. Please help us welcome Natalie Grant.
grace indeed will lead us home, everyone. That was actually sung on the full Virgo moon night. That was live that night. Wow. I can feel the energy of the new, everyone. May it be so much with all of us as we move this next period of time with grace, with divine grace, with peace in our hearts, and with the power of love in our thoughts, in our actions, and our deeds. May it be done, all these things we came to do together, and let it begin with me. I love you all, everybody. Mahalo and namaste, and come tomorrow and Monday night and join us again with Cheryl Croce. It's 9:15 and 6:15, respectively, East and West Coast. And the number is the same, 213-342-3000. The PIN code is 946-7441 pound. We'll see you there and in the light and on that bridge. Let's go visit those folks in the shuttle bay. See what they've learned while they've been up there. Namaste, everyone. Peace and love. Sat Nam.
Sat Nam Ji.
Aho Mitakuyasin.